You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
There was too much democracy. Therefore, that was the reason for this massive protest. The anti-war movement, etc., etc. Their analysis of the 60s had to do all with too much democracy. We have to shrink democracy. So the shrinking of democracy, the analogy is planned shrinkage on the housing front, is to undercut the ability of people to organize if you take out their house.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Frank Morales. Today's show, the squatter movement, seizing housing. Frank Morales is a writer and researcher whose work has been published in Covert Action Quarterly, Global Outlook, and Midnight Notes. He is the author of Police State America, U.S. Military Civil Disturbance Planning. He has written numerous articles, including Non-Lethal Warfare, Operation Garden Plot, The War at Home, Operations Other Than War, and Military Operations in Urban Terrain. Frank Morales is a New York City Lower East Side activist and squatter. Today we explore his work as a grassroots housing activist and leader of the squatter movement in New York City. Frank Morales, welcome.
Hi.
Frank, in addition to being a writer and a researcher, you describe yourself as a New York City Lower East Side squatter. What is a squatter?
Okay, squatter, the way I use the term, is a person or a group of people who, through direct action, secure a place to live. Specifically, on the Lower East Side here and in the Bronx, which is where, you know, I started squatting back in the early 80s, we mean taking abandoned property through seizing that property in the interest of creating housing and doing that collectively and having people who do this collectively organize the resources and the people power to renovate the buildings, to bring them up to code, because a lot of these buildings are trashed in the process of being abandoned. You know, they've either been burnt or whatever, so it requires a lot of work. So basically, by squatting, what we mean is direct action for housing. More sort of philosophically, is that the only way to ensure that people have a human right to a home, and that doesn't remain just an abstract concept, is to seize the housing. That kind of puts flesh on the bones of the whole issue of housing being a human right. It makes it real through the action of squatting, of realizing that right.
When did you start doing this?
I started squatting in 1979 in the South Bronx. The South Bronx is an area where there was quite a lot of displacement and destruction of people's housing. I don't know if people are familiar on the West Coast with some of the imagery of places like the South Bronx, where if you can just envision lot after lot, block after block, just leveled as though a bomb had hit, so there'd be whole neighborhoods. You could stand at the four corners in the Bronx and look in four directions and see nothing but, like, level, empty, brick-strewn lots where people once lived. Well, South Bronx went through this whole process of what we referred to and still do as spatial deconcentration, a form of planned shrinkage, so that when we were up there, there were a number of abandoned buildings that were sealed up and ostensibly were owned by the city. And we saw that under Reaganism, there was no way that people were going to be able to get affordable housing other than through direct action, other than through seizing the housing, renovating it, and then defending it collectively. And so that's what we began to do. So I started that in 1979 in the South Bronx. We took over two buildings there with people in the neighborhood and created housing and also utilized the storefronts for people's businesses and drop-in centers and that kind of thing. But the idea is that when people do it, you're immediately put in a situation of illegality, obviously, because under capitalism, you know, you worship private property, so people, you know, they didn't understand, in some cases, what we were trying to do, but we always felt that people had a moral right which surpasses the right to make profit, the right to survive, the right to life. And so that when we took the buildings, we would organize to defend them because we knew that there would be a reaction. And there was. And so the people, one of the main aspects of organizing around squatting then and still now was to organize the ability to defend yourself. So we relied a lot on each other, building networks of people who were both in the squats and in the neighborhoods that would come out and defend people's right to a home like that. So I started doing squatting up in the South Bronx at that point and moved down to the Lower East Side in 1985 because I grew up in this neighborhood. So, you know, I came back here for that.
Were you an organized group that did this when you started doing it in 1979?
No, we were neighborhood people who just saw that the buildings were sitting there and that it was clear that more and more people were being displaced. If you lived in the Bronx or in poor communities throughout the country and you could see that people were being pushed out, neighborhoods were burning down, banks were disinvesting from neighborhoods. It was a synergy of effects that was unleashed against these communities. From my perspective, a conscious strategy to depopulate the urban centers of people following the late 60s. They were seen as the terrain of insurrection, and therefore the strategies that were enacted to, the phrase being spatially deconcentrate these communities. We recognized that the only way we were going to survive the effort to displace us from these communities, these are poor, working class, poor people, you know, and artists and so forth and so on, was to seize the buildings directly, manage them ourselves. And we've proven that people can do this. You know, people tend to be able to cooperate if given an opportunity to work collectively together. In fact, that's one of the predominant features of being human. And that if you allow for that, then it's amazing what people can do. So that people manage these buildings, and that's how thing got going in the Bronx. In the early stages, there was a lot of community support, which was important to sustain them, local benefits in the neighborhood to raise money. I mean, don't forget, in 79 and 80, hip-hop was just really getting going up in this neighborhood. And we had a lot of connections with people in that area who would do, you know, a lot of stuff with us, and we'd raise money, and people who knew other people who needed housing were able to move in to the houses and so forth. So, you know, I've always advocated that people who are having difficulty affording where they're living, yeah, there's approaches that deal with rent strikes and seizing the occupied and vacant apartments and other kinds of strategies. But in terms of the abandonment situation in areas where there is abandonment and so forth, public entities, housing entities that have taken this property over and so on, they should take these properties and organize to defend them and renovate them and create housing for people, not as a way only to meet the short-term goal of creating housing for themselves and those that they're working with, but also to put political pressure on the system, which is set up right now to do nothing in terms of creating any kind of affordable housing for poor people. There isn't a penny of federal money that is going towards creating housing for the poor in this country. So the only way that people are going to get the kind of housing that they need, rather than prisons and shelters, which is another kind of housing that the state is supplying, they're going to have to take it through direct action. So that's what we started doing in the Bronx and then later on down here on the Lower East Side.
How would you do this? You would find an abandoned, boarded up building and what? Just open it up and move in?
Yeah, the way that we would do it is that, I'll give you kind of a summary. We have a kind of an ABCs of this. You know, we've wrote up a lot of this stuff over the years and publish and give it out to people because there is a bit of a science to it without sounding overly highfalutin. But we would take buildings that looked to be in decent shape and do a kind of reconnaissance, you know, have people go in and check them out, make sure that the buildings were structurally good. And we'd have friends who were architects and others who, you know, would help us do that. So that would be in the early stages. And here in New York, we were always telling people that what we were not about was creating some kind of public spectacle that would be symbolic squatting or something to create a protest and try to create a media event around making a demand of the city to provide housing, et cetera, et cetera. We were not about making demands. We were about basically working clandestinely to take the housing. Some of us have no confidence in the goodwill of the state to provide housing. And so, see, the demands is really kind of useless, and it's that using a clandestine approach, we would work in a building for 1, 2, or 3 months before we effectively put on the front door, so to speak. So we'd spent some time analyzing the situation in terms of ownership of the building and get that background information, organize groups of people who were compatible and, you know, who wanted to do this together. In the early stages here in New York, we'd collect mail, have people send mail to themselves or have others send mail at their address and meet the mailman on the street corner or something like this and begin to create a legal case for residency in the building. Because as people began to move in and actually live there, the powers that be might be interested in pushing them out and by creating a residency status as opposed to a trespass status. Basically, we took approaches that would ensure the most likely possibility of success. We were about creating housing. We weren't about creating kind of political statement or symbolic this or symbolic that. We took a kind of a paced approach to securing buildings for the long term. So after 2-3 months of clandestine kind of work within the building, both in terms of its immediate renovation, there's immediate needs for electric and water, et cetera, we would then go public, so to speak, and have the front door put on and kind of smoke out whatever opposition was going to be smoked out. And at that point, we'd be prepared to defend ourselves through having created some residency status there, having networked with people in the community to defend the building through public demonstrations and other kinds of approaches. And, you know, all in all, to give it our best shot for maintaining, holding the buildings. And we were successful both in the South Bronx in terms of the movement up there with people on the move and some of the groups that were working up there on it down here. Now, in terms of some of the politics of this thing, we always felt that, and to this day, believe that the buildings should and are, in fact, autonomous, that we never had any central organizing umbrella or something like this. Each of the buildings was autonomous. The people that worked there and lived there ran it. There was no outside authority to tell them what to do, who to bring in or who to evict or how much money they should put into renovating the building, so that we always maintained a strict autonomy among the various buildings and so on. But what was a centralizing element for us was the collective defense, so that what was referred to as our eviction watch network, which was a phone tree among other things, it was a defense mechanism apparatus, if you will, of the squatter scene down here that essentially constituted our organization. And that was it. It was not that we had any kind of centralized organization. We would have, obviously, a lot of sharing that happened between the buildings, and people would share tools and so forth. And at our peak, we were working in about 22 buildings here on the Lower East Side. We've lost a number through arson. We lost some buildings through Giuliani and some of the other mayors. They brought tanks and helicopters and SWAT teams and various approaches. And we, you know, we would mount campaigns to try to push that back. The long and short of it is 11 buildings have survived the onslaught of both yuppiedom and police state attack here in the Lower East Side. And now, to bring you totally up to date on this, is that these 11 buildings have received some kind of normalization from the city, wherein the ownership of these buildings that we're in, which we always felt was illegitimate anyway in terms of the city owning this or the city owning that, but from their point of view, title to our buildings has been transferred to this not-for-profit agency, which ostensibly will manage our sort of finishing renovations in some of the buildings to bring us up to code, and at which point the buildings will be transferred to us legally.
Well, it sounds like it's been very successful. I'm speaking with writer, researcher, and urban squatter Frank Morales. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Frank, when you talk about collectively defending the buildings, what you mean then is if the police showed up and wanted to evict you, that calls would go out in a large group of people would assemble, and yeah. What? Would that sort of intimidate the police?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not about violence. You know, we don't possess the kind of artillery that the SWAT team has. You know, in taking these buildings, we're not unconscious about what our status is in terms of the legal structure in this country. So we need to devise ways that we can defend ourselves. So we, you know, utilize different methods. And one of the things that we did early on was to create an eviction watch list, which was a phone tree that connected all the people in the buildings. And as I said, at one point we had 20-plus buildings. And this is roughly, what, 30, 40 people, I guess, per building. So it's like that kind of network. And also people in the neighborhood who we'd have a table on the corner of Tompkins Square Park on a Saturday afternoon and ask people who wanted to sign the eviction watch list so that if in the event that we were being pushed out, they would come to defend us. So they would sign up. People would sign up, and if they couldn't come, then they would be put on a separate list that from work they could call the city authorities who were evicting us. So in other words, everybody who wanted to help out could help out depending on where they were and what they could do and so forth. It was a question of organizing for defense. Once people understood, you know, what you were doing, they supported it. Obviously, the people in the buildings early on understood that, hey, if I don't support you and your squad, then you're not going to support me and mine. So it was very basic there. So a bunch of people would come out. We would expect all the squatters to come out to support each other. I mean, that was the vibe among people. It's like, you know, that was what, and that's what happened. That's why we were able to bring people out. So if there were two or three cops and some city officials in front of a building standing there with a pad in their hand saying, according to our records, this building belongs to, you know, so-and-so. And we'd say, well, we reside here. We've been fixing this building up. We're not leaving, period. And further than that, we're not letting you in if you don't have a warrant with somebody's name on it. We kind of trained ourselves to respond in this way. And little by little, people would start showing up. People would start chanting. We'd have a crew that had video cameras, and they would be taking pictures of all these people. Inevitably, the cops would pick it upstairs. They'd go to the phone, and they'd call the sergeant or whoever they call and say, boss, we don't know what to do with these guys, squatters. They seem to be, I don't know, they have mail. They got a Con Ed bill. I don't know what to do. They wouldn't know what to do, essentially, because, again, when you come outside of the realm of the experience of the enemy, so to speak, they're confused. They don't really know how to respond to you. They've adapted over time, but again, in general, it's when you come outside the realm of their experience, they don't quite know how to respond to you, and that's what happened. So basically, until the point that the political nature of what we were doing kind of hit home to the powers that be down at City Hall, when it was clear to them that they needed to nip the thing in the bud, then they would, from the top down, instruct the local police to go about and try to push us out, or they'd come, you know, they realized early on because we would defend ourselves. All the buildings had barricades, and we would have means of securing the building so that it wasn't going to be easy. We made it very difficult, and through letting the people know in the community and media releases to the press and so forth, you know, just basically showing people that unless people stood up, there wasn't going to be any housing for people. There wasn't going to be the ability for people to meet their basic needs. So we were trying to provide an example in some ways, but mostly we were organizing to defend ourselves. And, you know, it was effective to a large extent that we were able to maintain the buildings throughout a period of pretty intense repression from 85 to 90. You know, we had a bunch of run-ins with the police as functionaries for the real estate industry or the various mayors' political agendas or what have you.
Who owns the buildings that you squat in?
Who owns the buildings? Basically, when the abandonment took place, this whole planned shrinkage, when we created all this abandoned housing, which I was alluding to earlier, because the process of squatting emerges out of a situation where there's massive displacement, homelessness, and so forth. So that's the context within it takes place.
But, I mean, who were the original owners of the buildings then moved into?
Yeah, the thing is that these buildings, take the Lower East Side here, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s, a lot of these buildings were owned by what we might refer to as small owners, like, you know, ma and pa owners. They'd have a building, whatever. Sometimes after the late 60s, where I was making the point before, there were a whole series of things that took place which made it very difficult for small owners to maintain their buildings. Suddenly, there were new taxes put on them. There were various courts set up. In New York City, there was a court set up to bring in these small owners and take their buildings away from them for inability to pay taxes. Or in some cases where, you know, the owners just threw their arms up because the neighborhoods were burning down around them and they just had to get rid of them or what have you. All I'm saying is that the mechanisms for the transfer of massive numbers of units from diversified small owners into the hands of one public entity took place from, you know, the early 70s right through the sort of middle and later 70s. And an agency was set up in New York here called Housing Preservation and Development, which is a misnomer. But that agency was set up to basically take in all of these properties that were transferred from small owners into what essentially was a public agency that was going to broker these buildings to the rich over time and land bank them. So these abandoned buildings that were all cinder blocked up were ostensibly owned by the city, right, by the so-called public entity, the Housing Preservation and Development, which along with the Housing Authority and the public housing, the projects, was the biggest landlord in New York. They had, you know, 100,000 units when we started taking buildings here on the Lower East Side. They owned those buildings ostensibly through this process, which we always maintain was illegitimate and illegal. But essentially, that's how the city became the quote-unquote owner. Now, what they did with these buildings is just warehouse them. They didn't invest a whole lot of money in upgrading them. They just put cinder blocks on them, very often did not put any kind of tarps on the roofs or anything like that. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of apartments here, just block after block after block in different neighborhoods and down here. And the buildings were just sitting there, open to the elements, just sort of rotting away, some for 10, 15, 20 years. All right, so this Housing Preservation and Development is a misnomer. It was about land banking, keeping those buildings off the market, inflating the whole rental thing, and then later on brokering those buildings to the incoming, kind of the yuppie forces and various capital reinvestment and so forth after this whole period of massive disinvestment, redlining on the part of banks, where they wouldn't give those small owners secondary mortgages on their buildings. So it all contributed to this process where there was this massive abandonment and destruction of whole neighborhoods, not to mention arson for profit and, you know, the whole burning down of whole large sections. I mean, there were nights in the Bronx so I could stand on my roof and the sky would be red in some areas. There was a process which I feel was part of a social control mechanism. This wasn't simply the invisible hand of capitalism in the housing market, that there were strategies that were hatched as early as the Kerner Commission report in 68, which dealt with civil disorder in their Chapter 17 of the Kerner Commission report, which dealt with housing. All right, now this is the Civil Disorder Commission dealing with civil disorder, namely riots, so-called riots in the cities, and they have Chapter 17 deals with housing. And in there, they advocate a process of dispersal of the urban poor, forcing them out of the cities. What later was recognized to be this program known as spatial deconcentration. The concept and the mechanisms of this program was put forth by Yolanda Ward and the people from the Grassroots Unity Conference, Yolanda Ward being a black 22-year-old Howard University student who, along with some others, expropriated these documents from HUD, which referred to spatial deconcentration and the whole notion of displacing large numbers of poor people from the urban centers for fear that they pose a threat to the stability of America. At this point, 1967, don't forget, there were so-called riots in 109 cities in 1967 alone. So that the housing question, as it related to the issue of social control, became an operative aspect of the politics and the strategy of squatting both in the Bronx and on the Lower East Side here. We saw squatting as an antidote in some respects, not only to the short-term housing needs, but this whole process of spatial deconcentration that people had to defend themselves on the street in actual concrete ways to create communities of resistance, to resist not only the displacement, because if you think of it metaphorically, if a big fist comes down in a neighborhood and smashes a densely populated poor community in, let's say, Harlem, and all those people go shooting out of this dense fist, you know, if you see it visually, and they're shooting out all over the place, well, those people have to be, where are they going to go, right? Well, what we saw is that the process of spatial deconcentration, of planned shrinkage, of creating massive hundreds of thousands, if not millions of homeless people, displaced people around the country, was the parallel strategy that went along with that was the creation of the shelter system around the country. The shelter system emerged in, again, in the late 70s, early 80s, during this period following massive destruction of neighborhoods all throughout the late 60s and through the 70s. The federal shelter system was set up to, in a sense, reconcentrate all those people who had been pushed out of the urban centers, at least a good portion of them, who were now known as, quote-unquote, homeless people. They were never referred to as displaced former tenants. They were now this new breed of person called homeless person, which by now is a genocidal aspect when people are forced to live on the street or in shelters and so forth. The life expectancy rate in the shelter system is much lower than it is for the so-called normal population. the incidence of AIDS and TBs in the shelter is double what it is outside of the shelters, that it becomes really clear that, you know, the whole process of social control, spatially concentration, forcing people out of the inner cities and creating this homeless population as a form of state repression, there's also an element of genocide when you're thinking in terms of the seriously ill effects that people who are faced with this situation, you know, how they're living. So our strategy in terms of squatting had to do with survival, particularly in poor communities, had to do with, you know, empowerment to the degree that we're able to defend the buildings and so forth. And only secondarily, but still important, has to do with deconstructing the ideology, the sanctification of private property, that somehow the right to make a profit on a building, to speculate on buildings, this whole real estate gambit, you know, where people, this building was built, you know, that you're living in, you know, 60 years ago, and it's been paid for 15 times already, but this whole speculative process as it affects the housing market, that the whole thing was a sham, that squatting effectively could concretely and practically halt the process of speculation where it was occurring. In other words, in our buildings, there's been no speculation. The Lower East Side is completely gentrified, or at least in large segments of it are. And yet, that speculation passed over us. We were able to, you know, maintain our buildings as affordable and so forth. And this is what we're saying, is that the only way we're going to be able to really maintain our right concretely to a home that's affordable to people who fall within the kind of lower income working class category at this point in time is to seize it and to organize effectively to defend it.
So you are saying that spatial deconcentration was consciously planned, carried out, and it's actually referred to in this 1968 Kerner Commission report?
Yeah, if you go to the Kerner Commission report, which again was officially titled the National Commission on Civil Disorder, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. Again, it was set up in 68, and half of its participants were military and police people. According to the executive order which set it up under President Johnson, they were set up not only to study the causes of riots, so-called riots, and to deal with short-term solutions to riots, and that's where the Army Task Force, part of the Kerner Commission, came in terms of the use of non-lethal weapons and the setting up of Operation Garden Plot, which deals with civil disturbance planning and so forth. But Chapter 17 of that report deals specifically with the issue of housing and was authored by Anthony Downs. Anthony Downs, who has a long counterinsurgency history dealing with social control elements, police elements within poor communities, he authored that chapter and in there advocates a dispersal strategy for the urban centers. You know, this whole notion of, in a book that he wrote called Opening Up the Suburbs, which he advocated not only pushing people out of these poor communities as though the suburbs were going to be welcoming them with open arms. In any case, if you look at that chapter, then you get a sense of the direction that these counterinsurgency strategies, essentially, were looking to implement vis-a-vis housing. Most people have a difficult time bridging the question of housing and the whole notion of social control, particularly as it deals with kind of militaristic-sounding kinds of approaches. But if you looked at areas like the South Bronx and then realized, you know, these bombed-out areas and so forth, and realized that this was happening nationally across the country, to suggest that this was just some kind of invisible process that was not, you know, part of some sort of conscious strategy, particularly if you read Chapter 17 in the Kerner Report, is foolhardy. So, I mean, our analysis basically led us to position that squatting was a defensive tactic, on the one hand, to defend against this forced removal and to hold land and also to deconstruct, you know, ideologically the reverence for capitalism and private property, but at the same time to create communities of resistance, areas where people could organize in other areas as well. The reason being that these urban centers were under attack was because they were, in the late 60s, organizing effectively. The numbers of various liberation movements, as Black Panthers, the Young Lords, various others, peace, justice, liberation movements in the urban centers. Well, this is a threat. And the way to eliminate that threat in part, or as the Kerner Commission, Johnson's executive order, mandated, long-term solutions to riots. Well, long-term solutions to a riot in Harlem might be to displace a third of the population, which is essentially what they did.
I'm speaking with writer, researcher, and urban squatter Frank Morales. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, Frank, you say that the spatial deconcentration strategy led to the creation of a shelter system. Is this shelter system a national system?
Yeah, the spatial deconcentration, the pushing people out, forcing people out of communities led to the shelter system. If you look at the creation of the shelter system nationally, particularly under FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency chairs a board which oversees the shelter system across the country. They saw homelessness as an emergency management situation. So the shelter system was set up as separate and distinct from any kind of approach to dealing with housing. For instance, in New York here, these large-scale barracks were created where, you know, you'd have like a gymnasium full of cots, and you'd have people just sleeping on these cots in these barracks, right? That form of sheltering people, who mostly happen to be poor, black and Latino people, that approach would have been illegal prior to 1979 or, you know, in the early 80s. Basically, what occurred was that there were suits that were made, legal approaches, by, for instance, groups like the National Coalition for the Homeless in 79 and 80 in Washington, D.C., which is the same time FEMA is actually set up in Washington, D.C. in 79 and 80. But in any case, the suit that took place sued the city administration here in New York around the right to shelter, when in fact the New York State Constitution guarantees a right to a home. Now, the suit was not around a right to a home, right? So the state was not forced to create housing for homeless people or people who were underhoused. The suit was around a right to shelter, and what that did was to create the legislative infrastructure for the shelter system, which heretofore had been illegal, inhumane. In other words, you couldn't put people who were homeless in a barracks before the Coalition for the Homeless sued for the right to shelter as separate and distinct from the right to a home. So in any case, the National Coalition for the Homeless, emerging at this point, along with FEMA, which oversees the national board, which oversees the shelter system nationally, you know, add to that the actual day-to-day life within these barracks places. I refer to it as low-intensity detention center. Anyone who's been to them would recognize that. I mean, these are places that, you know, there's video surveillance apparatuses, you know, everywhere you look. They're like prisons. The guys are, and women are told they have to leave at 7 or 8 or 9 in the morning, and they can come back in only as late as so-and-so, and their lives are strictly regimented. That, as I said before, the life expectancy of people who are in these shelters, as well as people who are living on the streets, and who knows how many people won't go into these shelters. There have been studies. There was a study done by some medical people here in New York about this whole question of the shelter system. In any case, the approach has been towards controlling, detaining, isolating, disempowering people who, you know, were displaced in this area, and FEMA and the shelter system sort of, you know, came into being as part of that strategy.
I don't think that most people know that shelters used to be illegal. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been possible for the city of New York to, quote-unquote, house people or shelter people in a barrack-style approach. There are various what are called warrant of habitability laws. They wouldn't have met the standards that are required to make it a legal housing situation, so that the right to shelter suit forced the city's hand, quote-unquote, to put people in barracks where they could be more closely monitored, where the incidence of AIDS and TB would be much higher than it was on the street, and so on. That's just the objective circumstances of it. I mean, I tend to think that that was part of the strategy to avoid people organizing around the right to a home rather than a right to shelter, which confuses people, but they're quite different.
Could you talk a little bit more about how spatial deconcentration was accomplished? It sounded like there were small businesses who could not continue and had to either sell out or go bankrupt. Was this an attack on the middle and lower middle class? in the city centers after the riots of the 60s?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was very clear in the late 60s and 70s that a lot of the small owners were not able to maintain their buildings. And there were various things that took place. The most telling was the whole process of redlining on the part of banks. So, for instance, somebody who had a building here on 10th Street and Avenue B since the 20s had been getting their mortgages refinanced or what have you by the local bank and had the relationship with the bank and so forth all those years. Suddenly, the bank was not willing to refinance their loan. And people who owned buildings were not necessarily making money on rents. They were making any kind of profit that they could put back into the building if they were honorable from the refinancing that the bank would give them on their mortgage based on the upwardly spiraling value of their building, et cetera, et cetera. In any case, when the banks decided that they would no longer make loans or refinance mortgages in particular neighborhoods, right? And the concept redlining refers to, you know, a map inside of a bank president's office or something where they have a red line drawn around the neighborhood and they say, well, we're not giving any loans to that neighborhood. So the reality of it was that there was massive disinvestment on the part of certain banks targeting certain neighborhoods. They wouldn't make loans in those neighborhoods, even if they were situated in those neighborhoods. When I was living in the South Bronx in 1980, we went to a Citibank on the corner of 149th Street and 3rd Avenue, right in the center of the South Bronx, and we went into their bank, and through the Community Reinvestment Act, you're able, a public citizen is able to go into a bank and demand to see their community reinvestment portfolio, which basically lists the loans that they've made in that neighborhood. Okay? I think you can still do this. And they literally have to supply you with a little table and light and all that, and you can look through this. In any case, the bank on 149th Street and 3rd Avenue in the South Bronx that year made, I think it was like 150 loans like that. 149 of those loans were made to Westchester County people, which is, if you're familiar with New York, it's like the South Bank's very poor, and then the Westchester is very wealthy. So this bank was obviously utilizing the funds that were coming into it from the small savings that people had in that community. This is a poor neighborhood, and utilizing those funds but not giving anything back. If a person came in for a loan or some small business or some person who had a building who was looking to get their roof fixed and needed a loan, they couldn't get those. There was disinvestment. You couple this with other kinds of effects. Sanitation pickup suddenly decreased. They were picking up garbage three times a week. Then they only picked it up one time a week. There was all kinds of drugs that were coming into these neighborhoods at this point. Down here on the Lower East Side, you could stand, you know, in any of the four corners down here, and it was like a market. And people would be limos lined up, and people would be just scoring left and right. And everybody knows now that there was, you know, in some cases, some, like, collusion between the local so-called law enforcement and the drug pushers. So, I mean, you had this whole process. You have all these, what is referred to as a synergy of effects in these communities, which led to the destruction of these neighborhoods, the physical destruction. So, you know, when you're dealing on that level, there are certain military analogies that are not so far off, particularly when you're looking at a phrase like spatial deconcentration, which is a HUD term. It's used in some HUD documents. Others refer to planned shrinkage, or Downs in the Kerner Commission talks about dispersal, dispersing these urban populations and so forth. The process had led to the complete destruction of certain communities, the disenfranchising of large numbers of people because you can't vote if you're sort of on the move, you're a migrant, you don't have any address. And eventually, you know, the sort of reconcentration, if not worse, the reconcentration of people within these barrack-style so-called shelter system, which is a low-intensity detention center.
And the destruction of these neighborhoods, it sounds quite clearly, was done purposefully. This was a conscious plan. I think that's what's so shocking.
If you look at the period in 1967, 68, 69, in there was great fear among the corporate elite and their henchmen at the Pentagon and in Congress, that insurrection was breaking out. You know, maybe hard to recall what this was like, but they were very concerned that the ship of state was on rocky terrain. By 1975, the Trilateral Commission, David Rockefeller's European, Japanese, American think tank, issued the Crisis in Democracy report, you know, authored by Samuel Huntington, to NYU Press, 1975. which concludes with a statement that, therefore, there are potentially desirable limits to the indefinite extension of political democracy. That there are limits to the indefinite extension of political democracy. I mean, this is the sense that they had at that point was that there was what Huntington referred to in that report, Trilateral Report, as an excess of democracy. There was too much democracy. Therefore, that was the reason for this massive protest, the anti-war movement, et cetera, et cetera. Their analysis of the 60s had to do all with too much democracy. We have to shrink democracy. So the shrinking of democracy, the analogy is planned shrinkage on the housing front, is to undercut the ability of people to organize if you take out their house. The same Trilateral Report referred to the ominous equation from their perspective of education and political participation. Huntington at one point argues in the book that, there seem to be studies that black political participation is equated to black people going more to college. So by shrinking one, we might shrink the other. I mean, this is the kind of analysis these people made. The book is basically a blueprint for counter-revolution. And what you're seeing in terms of the attack on the ability of poor working-class people to move into higher education and so forth grows right out of this period. It's a counter-revolutionary strategies that deal in the issue of social control in terms of communities or on the housing question, on questions of health care, the availability of work, jobs, etc. It's all part of, from my perspective, it's all part of a counterinsurgency that grew out of this period and is still with us. I think these same notions are still operative in some senses. It's more pronounced now. But, it's hard for people to recognize that the kinds of things that took place in community after community after community around this country in terms of the displacement of massive numbers of people and the emergence of homeless population as being anything other than some invisible consequence of economy alone. You know, from the left point of view, well, capitalism doesn't want to supply housing for poor people, and that's why there's so many poor people and so forth and so on. Well, I think that if GM from its board headquarters can sit there and define the color of its left bumper from its boardroom right down to the shop floor, that's not a conspiracy. The elite is capable of organizing in its own self-interest and seeing that, particularly if you read reports coming out of the Kerner Report, which advocate these dispersal programs, it seems to me it's more likely that this is part of a conscious effort. At this point, we've seen the effect of it, the complete destruction of whole communities, the warehousing of people in shelter system, and at this point, given the kind of evolutionary kind of deleterious effects on people's health over a sustained period in terms of being homeless and so forth, that there's a genocidal aspect to it as well. So, I think that people really need to look very closely about what we're dealing with in terms of homelessness and so forth. It's an issue of state repression. It's not the invisible hand of economy or, you know, the sort of moral problem with the poor or God's wrath upon poor people or any number of kind of superstitions. This is a conscious strategy to keep people off balance. And then, you know, if it was about providing, but it was not about that, it's much more expensive, for instance, to maintain the shelter system than it is to provide the housing. In New York here, we have these so-called welfare hotels and so forth. It's everyday knowledge that there's massive amounts of fraud and money and all kinds of waste in these places. It's like what we hear about the prisons. It costs $150,000 a year to keep one inmate in a jail when we could build them a house, send them to school, and so forth. And so that's the point. It's not about that. It's about social control. It's about genocide. It's about disempowerment. So this is counterinsurgency within the context of housing. We need to break down the separations that we have in terms of these categories and begin to see some of these questions in a new way.
Frank, could you tell us again the name of the book you referred to? I think people would be interested in that.
Yeah, I think it's something that everyone should have in their library. It's called Crisis in Democracy. It's NYU Press. It's out of print, but these days maybe people know, can find these things. NYU Press, 1975. It's very worthwhile reading. You hear a lot about the Trilateral Commission from some of the more esoteric, sects, but it's real. I mean, there's this report, and it's interesting to me that it was authored by Samuel Huntington, who currently is pushing this whole clash of civilizations, and, you know, he's one of these people they constantly sort of recirculate, you know. He's kind of one of the intellectual, although it's an oxymoron, I mean, in terms of his politics and moral viewpoint. But in any case, it's The Crisis in Democracy, the final report of the Trilateral Commission, and it's, I think the subtitle is On the governability of society or something like that. It's basically dealing with the question of how to maintain the ship of state amidst the quote-unquote distemper, which is another word for protest of the period. And again, this is in 1975, so they're looking back, analyzing, making recommendations in terms of reducing the educational availability for blacks. It talks about the media as being a problem during Vietnam. You see where that's wound up. So it kind of lays out strategies. That and the Kerner Commission report, which I'd also recommend, particularly Chapter 17, if people are interested in the housing question as it relates to civil disorder. Again, we have to break down separation between these categories and begin to see exactly what's going on. So I would recommend both of those. And the Kerner Commission report, you know, you really want to get the original, the New York Times version, kind of like the Warren Commission version. That's okay, but it's less accurate. So you need the government printing office version of the Kerner Commission report, particularly Chapter 17.
I'm speaking with writer, researcher, and urban squatter Frank Morales. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Frank, I wanted to finish up with your personal experience in New York City. You mentioned that there are 11 buildings now that are occupied and perhaps owned by a nonprofit, but that in the process over the past few decades, several buildings were lost to arson.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about what happened now? Were some of the buildings attacked by the city?
Well, I wouldn't say they were attacked by the city. They were basically people who either are working in the interests of real estate people who saw us as a problem. Because don't forget, if people on a block recognize that, hey, some people took over those buildings and they're still there and so on, you create a model. You know, you inspire people to begin to move outside of the real estate game. And that once you begin to create an environment in a neighborhood that is not friendly to speculation. See, I mean, real estate people come into a neighborhood, they look, and if there's three or four squats on that block, they may not want to invest in that block. And it creates like a geometric effect. So it's very dangerous from the point of view of these real estate people.
You had mentioned Mayor Giuliani, and that when he was mayor there in New York City, that several of the buildings were attacked. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Well, we were, you know, a couple of cases. In 1989, we had a building on 8th Street here that suffered an arson. When I said it was, you know, you could smell the gasoline. The fire department came, and it was determined that it was an arson and so on and so forth. And we commenced to try to defend the building, and we had major showdown with the police on that. Just to give people a sense of what went down there, the night when it was finally determined that they were going to demolish the building, they surrounded not only the building with riot cops and so forth, but for four or five square blocks in the neighborhood, there was a cop posted every 10 feet, just a complete neighborhood. And in order to get home, you had to show ID. It was a sort of a martial law situation. In another case, we had a tank roll down 13th Street, an armored personnel carrier, along with SWAT teams and automatic rifles and helicopters, basically an all-out kind of military assault. The FEMA truck would be there coordinating communications and so on. I mean, these were, from our perspective, kind of police state, military-style operations. So we had a number of confrontations, and at that time, hundreds of people would come out from the neighborhood. We would get involved in, you know, kind of pushing and shoving with the police to defend the house. And some of those times were rough in the sense that, you know, we were not always able to withstand the kind of police repression that came down. We lost some buildings that way and had to watch them be demolished. But at the same time, we won the war in a sense because it would create so much negative publicity and would also give the city a sense that, hey, every time we make a move and try to take one of these buildings, it sets us back so much that they were unable after a period of time to just continually come at us because we kept the resistance up.
Frank, is there anything else that you would like to add that people need to know about this subject?
I just think that the important thing for people to know is that it's possible for people to work together. You know, people would say to us, well, you don't have the ability to renovate those buildings. You're not going to get people to work together that don't know each other. You know, there's all this kind of stuff. And that's the thing, is that if people have the audacity and the ability, the vision to make this move, to look at the building, do some research, get in there and start working on it, then people will realize how much power they have. And, you know, there's no way of knowing that unless you take action. It's like we're saying, there's no human right to a home unless it's in some abstract realm somewhere. You make it real. And once you make it real, people feel it. And I can't begin to explain to you what it feels like to function within a context of, and not to sound, you know, whatever, but it's freedom to get outside of the claws of this whole speculation in housing market, this whole profit-making off of the land. You know, the land can't be bought and sold. People's right to a home is literally that. But, you know, that whole thing which everybody lives with, if people could just taste what it's like to live free of that and to understand that it's not just to pay, you know, a 50% or 75% or whatever, like a lot of poor working-class people are paying these rents and so forth. The whole thing is a fraud. And if we organize to take buildings and to take land and create housing as a human right and do it collectively, there's no amount of police that can stop it once it's really gotten going. This is a phenomenon that's taking place around the world. I mean, the idea of people seizing the resources to create housing for themselves is the dominant movement in the world. And I'm not, it's not an extreme statement. There are more people moving from the rural areas to the urban centers over the last 10, 15 years than any other mass movement of people in history. The largest migration of human beings ever in the history of the planet is taking place currently, and it's a move from rural to urban. That's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of militarism, agriculture being bought up by the big corporation, et cetera, et cetera. People are coming into the cities. There's this large move. No urban center around the world is equipped to deal with housing people, particularly poor people, whether it's Nairobi, whether it's Lima, whether it's New York City. So things are no different here than they are in other places in terms of the ability or the willingness of the municipality to supply housing for poor and working class people that they can afford. So that's happening all over the planet. And what's happening as a result of that is that squatting is the predominant way that 75% of poor people around the world are currently housing themselves. Three-quarters of the housing that poor people are living in around the world, three-quarters, this is according to the United Nations Office on Human Settlements, three-quarters of the housing that they're currently living in, they made themselves. I mean, to me, that's a phenomenal statement, both in a positive and negative way. But the fact is that most people, poor people who are living in a house, it's a house they created. They made themselves. They've seized their squatting. They're moving to seize their right to survive. But it's also a right to life as opposed to mere survival under some exploitive rental situation. Because that's the thing that I was referring to before, is that in terms of moving in this way, that you understand what it is to live and not to just survive and it's sort of a slave to some, you know, greedy landlord. And I think that the more people and tenants as well realize this and begin to organize rent strikes in order to finance squats and begin to collaborate, because these are processes that create a negative environment for real estate speculation. It's a campaign of dissuasion, of getting real estate interests and not interested in your community. You start seizing land, and right away, they're not going to want to be there. This is something that I've always wanted to communicate to people about the possibilities that exist in terms of squatting, you know, kind of direct action for housing.
And Frank, as a squatter, I assume you don't pay rent.
No, we don't pay rent. What we do is we pool our financial resources. That, you know, people always said that, well, you guys just don't want to pay rent, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is that if we have to fix a roof and you have to put in some joists, these are 23-foot long, big, heavy beams, and if we have to put those in, nobody's giving us any money for this. We have to buy them. So basically, the monies that are used in the squats are to renovate the buildings and to renovate our houses, to create community spaces, community kitchens, to create areas that are public in terms of cafes and things like that, to organize in the context of freedom, not to give our money away to some landlord under the guise that they, quote-unquote, own the building, when it was built by, you know, some Italian, Yiddish, Irish people in this neighborhood 50, 60, 70 years ago, and has been bought and paid for 15,000 times over already. The whole speculation is just it's a fraud. It's a moral obscenity to have people paying out all this money to these people so that they can just sort of participate in greed, which is not healthy. It's not good for them. It's not beneficial to anyone. And so it's like if people begin to get a hold of this, and understand that it's a model for people in all kinds of places, all in different parts of the world, and it's happening all over the world, and that, you know, it's a way to empower communities. So I'm always suggesting to people that work in the housing area and so forth to begin to look seriously at this whole idea of squatting and direct action approaches to some of these areas and other creative means of utilizing rent strikes and other kinds of approaches to get housing. It's clear the federal government and the powers that be have no interest in creating affordable housing for people. They're only interested in big profits and gentrification and, you know, the kind of yuppie thing.
Yes, the problem is very severe here in California. The housing is so extremely expensive that it's basically has the population terrorized, in my view.
Yeah, in other parts of the country or in other parts of the world where you don't have abandoned structures, per se. I'm getting very sort of particular about it now, but if you're dealing in a situation where there's just fields and so forth, like in Lima or in Mexico City or in different parts of the world where squatting is done, well, they have a different approach because obviously they're not dealing with abandoned buildings. They're dealing with whole stretches of land where they go in, and in the course of a week or two, they create whole communities. So, you know, it's a level of organization that they've taken on, and they're implementing it and creating housing for themselves. Where there's a will, there's a way. People just have to get over the fear, the kind of ideological fixation on private property, and, oh, this is somehow not right, and this kind of thing, and begin to feel what it's like to be free, feel what it's like to live outside of that speculation, of that extortion racket that people assume is it exists, therefore it's right. Well, it's not. People can begin to feel that and feel their power in organizing for these kind of direct action takeovers and creating housing for themselves and collectively defending it.
Well, that's so inspiring. Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, thank you, Bonnie.
There's something happening here. Yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with author and housing activist Frank Morales. Today's show has been The Squatter Movement, Seizing Housing. Today's show was from November 2003. Frank Morales can be reached by email at frm@panix.com. That's frm@panix.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org. Follow us at G&B Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we're living in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am your editor and chief cook and bottle washer, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll feature American historian, lefty activist, and all-around good guy, Howard Zinn. Zinn died 2 years ago on January 27, 2010. We still have his writing and some recordings, though, and his words are well worth hearing. I hope you'll stay tuned. Howard Zinn was a Northeasterner, born and raised in Brooklyn, the child of poor immigrant Jews. His father was a factory worker, a window washer, a part-time waiter. In World War II, Zinn served as a bombardier in the Army Air Corps. Afterwards, he went to New York University on the GI Bill, then on to graduate school at Columbia. After a stint teaching at a black women's college in Atlanta, Spelman College, he ended up teaching for 24 years at Boston University. You want to compare him to his fellow lefty intellectual and neighbor Noam Chomsky, just down the road from Zinn at MIT. When Chomsky speaks on current affairs, you're struck by his large knowledge of modern history and political science. Though Chomsky is not at all pretentious, you can't miss his intellectual brilliance. Answering a question, he'll ad-lib a long, complex discourse that could pass as an excellent college lecture for senior political science majors. Pay very close attention to the full half hour his answer takes, and you'll be well rewarded. Alas, that doesn't lend itself well to radio. Howard Zinn, too, is best consumed in large doses. I think he's best read rather than heard. His celebrated People's History of the United States is well worth reading cover to cover, and more than once. Even here, on first acquaintance, the book may strike you as unremarkable. It looks like a good, solid, conventional history book. The intellectual brilliance here is of a quiet sort. It's in Zinn's choice of what historical facts to report, what speeches and documents and deeds to elaborate on, and what that shows us about how America operates. It's a first-rate alternative history. Alas, much of Zinn's writing doesn't lend itself well to radio. Neither does a good deal of his spoken words. He'll often summarize a lifetime of his research, tell you the main conclusions, without giving you a good helping of interesting historical facts. But sometimes his spoken words are good indeed, and I think we've caught some good ones today. Too bad you missed Occupy Wall Street, Howard. You would have loved it. Here's a nice clip of Zinn, apparently cut from a longer interview on video. It seems to be from the early 21st century. Here Zinn is speaking on a key theme for him, the causes of war. He argues that neither human nature nor the demands of a people lead young men off to war. Rather, wars are caused by the people's leaders, who work hard to persuade the people to go to war. Leaders persuade the people by two means. First, propaganda. Second, coercion. The draft and prison for draft resistors and other opponents of the war. Keep this in mind as our Iran war unfolds. Here's Howard Zinn.
I always found when in any discussion on war, inevitably, in any discussion on war, at a certain point in the discussion, somebody would say, oh, well, it's human nature. Well, first of all, from my own experience, and I still have to tell this to people because there are still people who talk about the desire of young men to go to war, the thrill it is for young men to be in war, to shoot their guns, to kill. And I thought about my own experience in the Air Force, and it was very clear to me, looking around at all these guys around me who were dropping bombs and who were killing people, that did not come from inside. It did not come from, oh, God, how good it would be to kill some people today. You know, there was no urge to kill, even though they were the enemy. No, what it came from was simply we had been trained. And also we had been told it's a good war. We've been told we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. It'll be bad if they won, it'll be good if we win. We've got to drop the bombs, and so we'll do it, and we'll do it as well as we can. But there was no spontaneous urge to kill. I mean, so that was my own personal experience, simply recoiled at the idea that soldiers have this kind of killing instinct, or the young men have this killing instinct. And then when I got away from my own experiences and just began to study history and history of wars, something else became clear to me, and that is wars don't take place out of the rush of a population demanding war. It isn't the population that demands war, it's the leaders who demand war and who prepare the population for war. World War I, I mean, you didn't have the American people clamoring for the United States to go to war. Not at all. In fact, if anything, it was the opposite. People did not want to go to war. That's why Woodrow Wilson, when he was campaigning in 1916, the war in Europe was on, and the question was, will the United States get into it? And Wilson, campaigning in 1916, and knowing that this would be a popular thing to say, said, no, we are not going to go to war. Then he's elected, and then almost immediately he calls upon the nation to go to war. But the nation doesn't respond immediately. If there was a spontaneous urge to kill, why would we need a draft? We would just take advantage of the natural desire of people to kill and give them an opportunity. But no, you have to draft people. Well, you have to do two things, really, in order to mobilize an army for war. You have to persuade them that this is a good thing to do, a noble thing to do. And you have to work very hard to persuade them, because after all, they're going to risk their lives. And so in World War I, a massive propaganda campaign was mounted by the Wilson administration. You know, they hired a number one sort of public relations person in the country to organize 75,000 speakers to go around the country to give speeches everywhere in the country. And the war spirit was built up. And the atrocity stories, the Huns, the Kaiser, really inflaming the public. Only then was it possible to really mobilize the nation for war. So you have, on the one hand, you have the propaganda campaign. And then on the other hand, you have the coercion, the draft, and the punishments. If you're neither seduced by the propaganda nor compelled to go by the draft, and if you resist, you will go to jail. So it takes, in other words, powerful inducements and threats to mobilize the young population of a nation for war. And if you had a spontaneous urge for war, you wouldn't have to do that. And in fact, there's no scientific evidence. I mean, when I got interested in the question of human nature, I would sort of look at the work of anthropologists and zoologists, you know, and I would read, you know, Conrad Lorenz on aggression, and who was, you know, a zoologist, and I would read the work of anthropologists who had studied different groups of people, primitive tribes, as we call them. And it was clear to me from looking at the works of anthropologists, there were some tribes that were fierce and some tribes that were peaceful. It clearly wasn't a universal quality. It depended on the conditions under which they lived. And this guy, Colin Turnbull, wrote books about the forest people and the mountain people. And the forest people, the pygmies in the forest, lived under the kind of conditions which made them violent. The people in the mountains were living under different kinds of conditions, and they were peaceful. So, you know, I just didn't see any scientific evidence. And even when, you know, somebody would, you know, refer me to the work of a scientist like E.O. Wilson, you know, Edward Wilson at Harvard, who wrote a book about sociobiology, and then he wrote a book on human nature. And they say, well, look, here's a very smart scientist, and he believes in the instinct for aggression. And so I read his book, E.O. Wilson's book, and it was, when I read it, it was very clear to me that no, that's not quite true. that Wilson, even though he talks about a propensity for aggression, says the environment determines whether any kind of propensity that you have is acted out. And also the word aggression is a very ambiguous term, because you can take out your aggressions in many ways. You don't have to take it out by killing people. And all subject to environmental circumstances. So to me, what was clear was that there was a very, very important political consequence of this belief in human nature as the basis for war and violence. Because the consequence of believing that wars come as a result of human nature is to place the blame for wars on individual people, on the citizenry, and to take away the blame from the leaders of the nation who are driving the country into war. So it then became very important for me to knock down, argue against that idea whenever I could. Because it's an idea so deeply ingrained in people, because it's of course, has this insidious effect of turning their attention away from the policymakers towards themselves. It's like telling the poor that you're poor because of your own faults and not because you live in a society in which the wealth is distributed unequally,
I think Zinn was saying, before he was rudely cut off in mid-word. Not by me. Zinn fought in World War II, a crew member of a bomber plane. He fought patriotically and without questioning what he was doing and why. What he was doing, mainly, was killing thousands of innocent civilians. Most of them had nothing to do with the enemy war effort. Many of them, Frenchmen, were even our nominal allies. No matter to the generals, then as now, they lied about surgical strikes and precision bombings of enemy war plants and collected another medal. After the war, Zinn began seriously exploring what forces led him to so blithely commit so many atrocities. And in the clip we heard, he summarized some of the answers he found. Above all, he advises, don't fall for the lie that war is an inescapable part of human nature. It's not. In the next excerpt, Zinn says more on these themes, and he talks about current political events. He's speaking in 2006, but alas, the political events are still current. He caught the propaganda buildup to our coming war with Iran. Interestingly, he also seems to predict the Arab Spring of 2011, 5 years before it happened. He begins, though, with the insights of his fellow military flyboy, Hermann Göring.
And you've seen those signs saying, no human being is alien. I think that's true, except for the people in Washington. They say, they've taken over the country, they've taken over the policy, they've driven us into two disastrous wars. Disastrous for our country and even more disastrous for the people in the Middle East. They have sucked up the wealth of this country and given it to the rich and given it to the multinationals, given it to Halliburton, given it to the makers of weapons. They're ruining the environment and they're holding on to 10,000 nuclear weapons while they want us to worry about the fact that Iran may, in 10 years, get one nuclear weapon. How mad can you be? The question is, how has this been allowed to happen? How have they gotten away with it? They're not following the will of the people. They manufactured a will of the people for a very short time, right after the war started, as governments are able to do right after the beginning of an armed conflict. You know, they're able to create an atmosphere of war hysteria. And so for a short time, they captivated the minds of the American people. That's not true anymore. The American people have begun to understand what is going on and have turned against the policies in Washington. But, of course, they are still there. You know, they are still in power. The question is, you know, how do they get away with that? So, in trying to answer the question, I looked a little at the history of Nazi Germany. No, it's not that we are Nazi Germany, but you can learn lessons from everybody. In this case, I was interested in the ideas of Hermann Göring, who, you may know, was second in command to Hitler, head of the Luftwaffe. And at the end of World War II, when the Nazi leaders were put on trial in Nuremberg, Hermann Göring was in prison along with other of the leaders of the Nazi regime. And he was visited in prison by a psychologist who was given the job of interviewing the defendants at Nuremberg. And he asked Göring, how come the Nazis were able to get the German people to go along with such absurd and ruinous policies of war and aggression? And Göring said, why, of course, the people don't want war. Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war? But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism. It works the same way in any country. I was interested in that last line. It works the same way in any country. I mean, here, these are the Nazis. That's the fascist regime. We are a democracy, but it works the same way in any country. Whatever you call yourself, whether you call yourself a totalitarian state or you call yourself a democracy, it works the same way. And that is the leaders of the country are able to cajole or coerce and entice the people into war by scaring them, telling them they're in danger, and threatening them and coercing them that if they don't go along, they will be considered unpatriotic. And this is what really happened in this country right after 9/11. And this is what happened right after Bush raised the specter of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and got for a while the American people to go along with this. But the question is, how did they get away with it? What about the press? What about the media? Isn't it the job of the press? Isn't it the job of the media? Isn't it the job of journalism to expose what governments do? Don't journalists learn from I.F. Stone, who said, just remember two words, he said to young people who were studying journalism. He said, just remember two words, governments lie. Well, but the media have not picked up on that. The media have gone along. You know, they are having trouble. They're getting desperate about recruiting for the military, going to all sorts of lengths. And, of course, they're concentrating. They send their military recruiters into the poorest schools because they know that the working-class kids are the most vulnerable, the most needy, the ones who they need an education, they need a skill, and so on. And so they're trying to prey on the working class. And Eugene Debs said, if you don't mind my quoting Eugene Debs said in a speech during World War I, which landed him in jail, the master class has always started the wars. The working class has always fought the wars. Of course, that has been true all the way. So we will at some point get out of Iraq. But I want to suggest one thing. We have to think beyond Iraq and even beyond Iran. We don't want to have to struggle against this war and then against that war and then against the next war. We don't want to have an endless succession of anti-war movements. It gets tiring. And we need to think and talk and educate about the abolition of war itself. You see, well, I was talking to my barber the other day. He said, Howard, he said, you know, you and I disagree on many things, but on one thing we agree. War solves nothing. And I thought, yeah, it's not hard for people to grasp that. And there again, history is useful. We've had a history of war after war after war after war. What have they solved? What have they done? Even World War II, the good war, the war in which I volunteered, the war in which I dropped bombs, the war after which I received a letter from General Marshall. general of generals, a letter addressed personally to me and to 16 million others, in which he said, "We've won the war, it will be a new world." Well, of course, it wasn't a new world. It hasn't been a new world. War after war after war. And I came out of that war, the war in which I'd volunteered, the war in which I was an enthusiastic bombardier, I came out of that war with certain ideas which just developed gradually at the end of the war, ideas about war. One, that war corrupts everybody who engages in it. War poisons everybody who engages in it. You start off as the good guys, as we did in World War II. They're the bad guys. They're the fascists. What could be worse? So they're the bad guys. We're the good guys. And as the war goes on, the good guys begin behaving like the bad guys. You can trace this back to the Peloponnesian War. You can trace it back to the good guy, the Athenians, and the bad guys, the Spartans. And after a while, the Athenians become ruthless and cruel like the Spartans. And we did that in World War II. We, after Hitler committed his atrocities, we committed our atrocities. Now, our killing of 600,000 civilians in Japan, our killing of probably an equal number of civilians in Germany, they weren't Hitler, they weren't Tojo, they were just ordinary people, like we are ordinary people living in a country that is a marauding country, and they were living in countries that were marauding countries, and they were caught up in whatever it was and afraid to speak up. I came to the conclusion, yes, war poisons everybody. And war, this is an important thing to keep in mind. When you go to war against a tyrant, and this is one of the claims, oh, we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein, which was, of course, nonsense. Did our government care that Saddam Hussein tyrannized his own people? We helped him tyrannize his people. We helped him gas the Kurds. We helped him accumulate weapons of mass destruction, really. But when you go to war against a tyrant, the people you kill in the war are the victims of the tyrant. The people we killed in Germany were the victims of Hitler. The people we killed in Japan were the victims of the Japan Imperial Army, you know. And the people who die in wars are more and more and more people who are not in the military. You may know this about the different ratio of civilian to military deaths in war, how in World War I, 10 military dead for one civilian dead. In World War II, it was 50-50, half military, half civilian. In Vietnam, it was 70% civilian and 30% military. And in the wars since then, it's 80% and 85% civilian. I became friends a few years ago with an Italian war surgeon named Gino Strada. He spent 15 years doing surgery on war victims all over the world, and he wrote a book about it, Green Parrots, Diary of a War Surgeon. He said, in all the patients that he operated on in Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere, 85% of them were civilians, one-third of them children. If you understand, and if people understand, and if you spread the word of this understanding, that whatever is told to you about war and how we must go to war and whatever the threat is or whatever the goal is, democracy or liberty, it will always be a war against children. They're the ones who will die in large numbers. The war, well, Einstein said this after World War I. He said, war cannot be humanized. It can only be abolished. War has to be abolished, you know. And I know it's a long shot. I understand that. But when something is a long shot, but it has to be done, you have to start doing it. Just as the ending of slavery in this country in the 1830s was a really long shot, but people stuck at it. And it took 30 years that slavery was done away with. And we can see this again and again. So we have a job to do. We have lots of things to do. One of the things we can learn from history is that history is not only a history of things inflicted on us by the powers that be. History is also a history of resistance, is a history of people who endure tyranny for decades, but who ultimately rise up and overthrow the dictator. We've seen this in country after country, surprise after surprise. Rulers who seem to have total control, they suddenly wake up one day and there are a million people in the streets, and they pack up and leave. This has happened in the Philippines and in Yemen, in all over, in Nepal. Million people in the streets, and then the ruler has to get out of the way. So this is what we're aiming for in this country. Everything we do is important. Every little thing we do, every picket line we walk on, every letter we write, every act of civil disobedience we engage in, any recruiter that we talk to, any parent that we talk to, any GI that we talk to, any young person that we talk to, anything we do in class, outside of class, everything we do in the direction of a different world is important, even though at the moment they seem futile, because that's how change comes about. Change comes about when millions of people do little things which at certain points in history come together, and then something good and something important happens. Thank you.
The late Howard Zinn. We heard excerpts from a long speech he gave in Madison, Wisconsin, in the fall of 2006. Audio courtesy of democracynow.org. Before that, from a video interview, courtesy of Brass Check TV, brasscheck.tv.com. I have gently edited all the audio you heard. Thanks for listening to New World Notes. Next week, if all goes well, we'll hear from Zinn's former neighbor and fellow adoptive Bostonian, Noam Chomsky. So a toast to the city of Boston, the land of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells speak only to Cabots, and the Cabots speak only to God. But Howard Zinn speaks to us all. And New World Notes speaks to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Illegitimi non carborundum, keep trying to speak the truth, and please tune in again next week. And as my students spell it, C-H-O-W, ciao!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Some truth. I've had enough of reading. Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the second and final part of a show done by James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com called Follow the Money. When it comes to 9/11, there are lots of unanswered questions and destroyed evidence concerning who benefited financially from the events of 9/11. So let's begin. Here he is, James Corbett.
Perhaps the most frank admission of insider trading is notable for three things. It was recorded on video. It has never been investigated by any agency or law enforcement official. And it was made by former CIA agent and frequent foreign policy commentator Robert Baer, the real-life inspiration for the character portrayed by George Clooney in Syriana. Talking to citizen journalists after a speaking event in Los Angeles in 2008, Baer was recorded on video making a startling assertion about 9/11 insider trading.
And then the last thing I would leave you with is National Reconnaissance Office was running a drill, a plane crash into their building, and you know they're staffed by DOD
and CIA. I know the guy that went into his broker in San Diego and said, cash me out, it's going down tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah.
That tells us something.
Wow. What?
That tells us something.
Well, his brother worked in the White House.
This truly remarkable statement bears further scrutiny. If Baer is to be believed, a former CIA agent has firsthand knowledge that a White House insider had foreknowledge of the attacks. And to this day, not only has Baer never revealed the identity of this person, but no one has questioned him about his statement or even attempted to pursue this lead. So how is it possible that the SEC overlooked, ignored, or simply chose not to pursue such leads in their investigation? The only possible answer, of course, is that the investigation was deliberately steered away from such persons of interest and any connections that would lead back to foreknowledge by government agencies, federal agents, or their associates in the business world. Unfortunately, we will likely never see documentary evidence of that from the commission itself. One researcher requesting access under the Freedom of Information Act to the documentary evidence that the 9/11 Commission used to conclude that there had been no insider trading received a response that stated that the potentially responsive records have been destroyed. Instead, we are left with sources that refuse to be identified, saying that CBOE records of pre-9/11 options trading have been destroyed, and secondhand accounts of traders who had heard talk of an event in advance of 9/11. In a roundabout way, perhaps the 9/11 Commission reveals more than it lets on when it tries to dismiss key insider trades with the pithy observation that the traders had no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. If those with foreknowledge of the attacks weren't connected to Al-Qaeda, what does that say about the identity of the real 9/11 perpetrators?
ABC News has now learned that the Chicago Board of Options Exchange launched their investigation into the unusual trading last week. That may have given them enough time to stop anyone from profiting from death here in the U.S. It may also give investigators, Peter, a hot trail that might lead them to the terrorists.
Thanks very much. As a reminder of the complications here, though, the Secretary of the Treasury said today of this investigation, you've got to go through 10 veils before you get to the real source.
Yep.
PTEC was a Quincy, Massachusetts-based company specializing in enterprise architecture software, a type of powerful computer modeling program that allows large-scale organizations to map their systems and employees and to monitor them in real time. The person running this software has a god's-eye view of processes, personnel, and transactions, and even the ability to use this data to foresee problems before they happen and to intervene to stop them from happening. As a senior consultant working on risk management for J.P. Morgan at the time of 9/11, Indira Singh was looking for exactly this type of software to implement the bank's next-generation risk blueprint. In her search for the ultimate risk management software, PTEC's name was floated as the best candidate for the task.
I had a good life. I did risk at J.P. Morgan Chase. Just to take a break from all the heavy stuff, what I do was to devise a way to monitor everything going on in a very large company to stop big problems from happening. There's that little cloud there and my very bizarre picture of how I think about this problem. I am a person who was merging two disciplines, risk management and something called enterprise architecture, which is fairly esoteric, but at the end of the day, we seek to prevent large problems from happening anywhere in a large global enterprise. At J.P. Morgan, I was working on the next generation risk blueprint, which is all about how to prevent these things from happening. Bad business practice, such as money laundering, road trading, and massive computer failures, anything you could imagine would go wrong. I had a lot of leeway consulting as a senior risk architect to think out of the box and actually get my ideas implemented. I was funded out of a strategic fund. I reported to the directors, and I was pretty happy. J.P. Morgan thought very highly of me, and they were thinking of funding, in conjunction with my project in D.C., the next generation risk software. What I needed to do, what I did, was a really smart piece of software. Really, really smart. Its job would be to think about all the information. And this is where you may connect a dot. The job of this software would be to think about all the information that represented what was going on in the enterprise at any given time as bank business was being transacted worldwide. For example, it would be a surveillance software that would look for trading patterns that indicated someone was up to no good and then do something about it, send a message somewhere, send the transaction information somewhere, perhaps shut their system down, perhaps shut another system down, perhaps start something else up elsewhere. This kind of capability is very, very essential in today's world. However, this kind of software is not found in Microsoft or not even in IBM. A small group of very esoteric software companies make this kind of enterprise software, and it is very pricey. So you can't afford to pick wrong. And I asked all my colleagues who are industry gurus, what would they recommend for this? My buddies recommended PTEC.
Indeed, it's not difficult to see why PTEC came so highly recommended. Given the nature of this sensitive risk management work, only a company with experience delivering software to large-scale organizations with secrets to protect would fit the bill, and in this regard, PTEC did not disappoint. Their client roster included a veritable who's who of top-level corporate and governmental clients: the FBI, the IRS, NATO, the Air Force, the Naval Air Command, the Departments of Energy and Education, the Postal Service, the U.S. House of Representatives, the Department of Defense, the Secret Service, even the White House. From the inner sanctum of the White House to the headquarters of the FBI, from the basement of the FAA to the boardroom of IBM, some of the best secured organizations in the world, running on some of the most protected servers housing the most sensitive data, welcomed PTEC into their midst. PTEC was given the keys to the cyber kingdom to build detailed pictures of these organizations, their weaknesses and vulnerabilities, and to show how these problems could be exploited by those of ill intent. But like all such systems, it could be exploited by those of ill intent for their own purposes, too. Given the nature of the information and secrets being kept by its clients, it should come as no surprise that many of PTEC's top investors and employees were men with backgrounds that should have been raising red flags at all levels of the government. And as it turns out, at least one of these men did raise red flags with a pair of diligent FBI field agents. In the late 1990s, Robert Wright and John Vincent, FBI special agents in the Chicago field office, were running an investigation into terrorist financing called Vulgar Betrayal. From the very start, the investigation was hampered by higher-ups. They were not even given access to the computer equipment needed to carry out their work. Through Wright and Vincent's foresight and perseverance, however, the investigation managed to score some victories, including seizing $1.4 million in terrorist funds. According to Wright,
"These funds were linked directly to Saudi businessman Yassin Qadi."
Yassin Al-Qadi is a multimillionaire businessman and philanthropist who, according to Business Associates, liked to boast of his relationship with former Vice President Dick Cheney. But in the late 1990s, he was sanctioned by the UN Security Council for his suspected links to Al-Qaeda, and after 9/11 he was put on a terrorist watch list by the US Treasury for his suspected ties to terrorist financing. During the 1990s, as Vulgar Betrayal was being thwarted from opening a criminal investigation into his activities, the Qadi-backed investment firm Sarmony Limited became an angel investor to a software startup called PTEC, providing $5 million of the initial $20 million of capital that got PTEC off the ground. At the time, PTEC's CEO denied that Al-Qadi had any involvement with the company other than his initial investment, but the FBI now maintains he was lying, and that in fact Al-Qadi continued investing millions of dollars in the company through various fronts and investment vehicles. Company insiders told FBI officials that they were flown to Saudi Arabia to meet PTEC's investors in 1999, and that Al-Qadi was introduced as one of the owners. It has also been reported that Hussein Ibrahim, PTEC's chief scientist, was Al-Qadi's representative at PTEC, and Al-Qadi's lawyers have admitted that Al-Qadi's representatives may have continued to sit on PTEC's board even after 9/11. Ibrahim himself was a former president of BMI, a New Jersey-based real estate investment firm that was also one of the initial investors in PTEC and provided financing for PTEC's founding loan. PTEC leased office space and computer equipment from BMI, and BMI shared office space in New Jersey with Qadi International, owned and operated by none other than Yasin al-Qadi. In 2003, counterterrorism czar Richard Clark said, BMI held itself out publicly as a financial services provider for Muslims in the United States. Its investor list suggests the possibility this facade was just a cover to conceal terrorist support. Suhail Lahir was PTEC's chief architect. When he wasn't writing the software that would provide PTEC with detailed operational blueprints of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. government, he was writing articles in praise of Islamic holy war. He was also fond of quoting Abdullah Azzam, Osama bin Laden's mentor and the head of Maktab al-Kidamat, which was the precursor to al-Qaeda. That such an unlikely cast of characters were given access to some of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. federal government is startling enough. That they were operating software that allowed them to map, analyze, and access every process and operation within these agencies for the purpose of finding systemic weak points is equally startling. Most disturbing of all, though, is the connection between PTEC and the very agencies that so remarkably failed in their duty to protect the American public on September 11, 2001.
Could you describe the relationship of PTEC with the FAA? Now, PTEC worked with the FAA for several years, didn't they?
Yes, they worked the FAA. It was a joint project between PTEC and MITRE, and they were looking at, it's interesting, they were looking at basically holes in the FAA's interoperability with responding with other agencies, law enforcement, in the case of an emergency such as a hijacking. So they were looking for the escalation process, what people would do, how they would respond in case of an emergency, and find the holes and make recommendations to fix it. Now, if anyone was in a position to understand where the holes were, PTEC was, and that's exactly the point. If anybody was in a position to write software to take advantage of those holes, it would have been PTEC.
Now, was there a reference to PTEC having operated in the basement out of the FAA?
Yes. Now, typically, because the scope of such projects are so overarching and wide-ranging, when you are doing an enterprise architecture project, you pretty much have access to how anything in the organization is being done, where it's being done, on what systems, what the information is, and you pretty much have carte blanche. Now, if it's a major project that spans several years, the team that comes in has literally access to almost anything that they want because you're operating on a blueprint level, on a massive scale. So, yes, they were everywhere, and I was told that they were in places that required clearances. I was told that they had log-on access to FAA flight control computers. I was told that they had passwords to many computers that you may not on the surface think has anything to do with finding out holes in the system. But let's say you've said, okay, you isolated a part of a process of a notification process that was mediated by a computer and you wanted to investigate it further, then you would typically get log-on access to that computer. And from that back upstream or downstream. So who knows? You know, from my own experience, I could have access to almost anything I wanted to in JP Morgan Chase and didn't for the reason if anything went wrong, I didn't want to have the access. But if you were up to no good as an enterprise architect with such a mandate, you typically could have anything you wanted.
So who was really behind PTEC? Did Ziadi, Ibrahim, and the others somehow evade the due diligence of all of the government agencies and multinational corporations that PTEC contracted with? Did PTEC just happen to end up working on the interoperability of the FAA and the Pentagon systems on the morning of 9/11? Did al-Qadi's friend Dick Cheney really know nothing of Qadi's connections or activities? Was this all some devious al-Qaeda plot to infiltrate key systems and agencies of the U.S. government? Not according to the people who were really investigating the company. So what did the 9/11 Commission have to say about PTEC? Absolutely nothing. The co-chair of the commission, Thomas Kane, had been involved in a $24 million real estate transaction with BMI, one of the PTEC investors, but no mention was made of that at the time, and the commission never looked into PTEC or its activities on 9/11. Meanwhile, Cheney's friend al-Qadi has since been removed from the Swiss, European, UN Security Council, and US Treasury terrorist sanctions lists. And Robert Wright? After Vulgar Betrayal was shut down, the FBI did eventually raid PTEC's offices in December of 2002, but not before the company was given 2 weeks' advance warning of the raid. The very next day, then-Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge declared that PTEC in no way jeopardizes the security of the country. Osama Ziadi is still wanted by the FBI for lying about al-Qaeda's involvement with the company, but the case is now cold.
To the families and victims of September 11th, on behalf of John Vincent, Barry Carmby, and myself, we're sorry.
The topic today is an adversary that poses a threat, serious threat to the security of the United States of America. This adversary is one of the world's last bastions of central planning, governs by dictating five-year plans, a single capital that attempts to impose its command across time zones, continents, oceans, and beyond. With brutal consistency, it stifles free thought and crushes new ideas, disrupts the defense of the United States, and places the lives of men and women in uniform at risk.
On September 10th, 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld declared a new war. Not a war on a shadowy terrorist organization in Afghanistan, or even a war on terror itself, but a war on the Pentagon.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy.
Perhaps it is no surprise that Rumsfeld felt compelled to declare a war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy. The issue of the Pentagon's $2.3 trillion accounting nightmare had been dogging him since his confirmation hearings in January of 2001. Although Rumsfeld was interested in pushing forward a modernization of the military that was projected to cost an additional $50 billion in funding, that agenda was politically impossible in the face of the Department of Defense's monumental budget problem.
How can we seriously consider a $50 billion increase in the defense budget When DOD's own auditors say the department cannot account for $2.3 trillion in transactions in 1 year alone? Now, my question to you is, Mr. Secretary, what do you plan to do about this?
Decline the nomination. Senator... I have heard...
I don't want to see you do that.
We'll stand adjourned in that case.
Senator, I have heard some of that and read some of that, that the department is not capable of auditing its books. It is terrifying.
Terrifying only begins to describe the problem. The Department of Defense's own Inspector General report for fiscal year 1999 noted that the Defense Finance and Accounting Service had processed $7.6 trillion of department-level accounting entries in that year. Of that amount, only $3.5 trillion could be properly accounted for. $2.3 trillion in transactions were fudged to make entries balance, run through without proper documentation, or made up entirely. The Inspector General's office did not even examine the other $1.8 trillion in transactions because they did not have adequate time or staff to review them. In 2002, one DFAS accountant blew the whistle on the problem and the cover-up that was underway to stop investigators from finding out where the money went.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere $300 million.
We know it's gone, but we don't know what they spent it on.
Jim Minnery, a former Marine turned whistleblower, is risking his job by speaking out for the first time about the millions he noticed were missing from one defense agency's balance sheets. Minnery tried to follow the money trail, even crisscrossing the country looking for records.
The director looked at me and he says, "Why do you care about this stuff?" It took me aback, you know. My supervisor asked me why I care about doing a good job. So
he was reassigned and says officials then covered up the problem by just writing it off.
As controller of the Pentagon from 2001 to 2004, Dov Zakheim was the man tasked with solving this problem.
There are all kinds of long-standing rules and regulations about what you can do and what you can't do. I know Dr. Zakheim's been trying to hire CPAs because the financial systems of the department are so snarled up that we can't account for some $2.6 trillion in transactions that exist, if that's believable. And yet we're told that we can't hire CPAs to help untangle it in many respects.
Mr. Secretary, the first time and the last time that Dove Zackheim and I broke bread together, he told me he'd have a handle on that $2.6 trillion by now, but we'll discuss that a little.
You've got a handle, it's just a little hot.
From 1987 to 2001, Zackheim headed SPC International, a subsidiary of System Planning Corporation, a defense contractor providing air warfare, cybersecurity, and advanced military electronics to the Department of Defense and DARPA. SPC's radar physics laboratory developed a remote control system for airborne vehicles that they were marketing to the Pentagon prior to 9/11. Zackheim was also a participant in drafting Rebuilding America's Defenses, a document that called for a sweeping transformation of the U.S. military, including the implementation of the $50 billion missile defense program and increased use of specialized military technologies. The paper even noted how advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. Rebuilding America's Defenses was a white paper produced by the Project for the New American Century, a group founded in 1997 with the goal of projecting American global dominance into the 21st century. Joining Zackheim in the group were a host of other neocons who ended up populating the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Jeb Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld. In their September 2000 document, the group lamented that their plan for transforming the military was not likely unless a defining event took place, one that would galvanize public opinion. The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor.
We know that the thing that tends to register on people is fear. And we know that tends to happen after there's a Pearl Harbor, tends to happen after there's a crisis. And that's too late for us. We've got to be smarter than that. We've got to be wiser than that. We have to be more forward-looking. There's a wonderful book on Pearl Harbor by Roberta Wohlstetter and foreword by Dr. Schelling that talks about this problem of seeing things happen and not integrating them in your mind and saying, yes, we need to be doing something about that now, that I reread periodically because it's so important.
And on 9/11/2001, America received its new Pearl Harbor. The attack on the Pentagon struck Wedge 1 on the west side of the building. An office of the U.S. Army called Resource Services Washington had just moved back into Wedge 1 after renovations had taken place there. The office was staffed with 45 accountants, bookkeepers, and budget analysts. 34 of them were killed in the attack. A 2002 follow-up report from the DOD Inspector General on the missing trillions noted that a further $1.1 trillion in made-up accounting entries were processed by the Pentagon in fiscal year 2000, but they did not even attempt to quantify the missing funds for 2001. The Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, later explained they were unable to produce a financial report for 2001 at all due to the loss of financial management personnel sustained during the September 11th terrorist attack. Before becoming Secretary of the Army, Thomas White was a senior executive at Enron. Enron was one of the largest energy companies in the world, posting a $111 billion profit in 2000 before being exposed as an elaborate corporate accounting fraud in 2001. The SEC, which investigated the Enron scandal, occupied the 11th to 13th floors in World Trade Center Building 7, and their offices were destroyed on 9/11, destroying 3,000 to 4,000 documents on active investigations in the process. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy did not yield the results he promised. By 2013, the unaccountable money in the Pentagon's coffers had reached $8.5 trillion.
The latest scandal to hit Washington comes from a report revealing the Pentagon misplaced $8.5 trillion. Military leaders have also been found ordering subordinates to doctor books to hide the missing money. This is the conclusion of a special report by Reuters. One former Pentagon employee, Linda Woodford, said she spent 15 years there falsifying financial records. Woodford had a job checking Navy accounting records against figures supplied by the Treasury Department. She said money was missing from the report every month.
And national security expert Steve Miles is here with me to help us crunch these numbers. $8.5 trillion unaccounted for?
It's a lot of money. This is the kind of thing that you would think would bring Capitol Hill to a screeching halt. There'd be hearings kind of almost daily. You'd have various committees looking into it. None of that. It just leads to massive waste, and there can be all sorts of fraud that you don't know about. Just one example, when the Inspector General looked at Iraq, which was, you know, a lot of money, but in the grand scheme, just a portion of the money the U.S. spends. What they found was about $50 billion of the money the U.S. spent there was wasted. And about $6 billion was completely lost. They had no idea where it went. It was completely unaccounted for. But put that in perspective, that's about this amount of money that other countries would spend on their defense in a year total. And that's just the loose pocket change that we lost in the couch.
One thing I found very interesting in this report is that the Pentagon apparently uses a standard operating procedure to enter false numbers or so-called plugs to cover lost or missing information in their accounting in order to submit a balanced budget to the Treasury. So they can write in everything.
That's probably the most shocking part of this, is that they get to the end of the day and they say, oh, there's money missing. What do we do? Well, we'll just put a number in there that says it's there and we'll sort it out later. I mean, again, this is the type of operating practice that if you did it in your own business, if you tried to do it with your own taxes for the government, they'd haul you off to jail.
But then, given that the trillions have never been accounted for, and given that American defense spending soared to record levels after the attack, perhaps Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon, the one he announced on September 10th, was successful after all. And perhaps September 11th was the key battle in that war.
Some might ask, how in the world could the Secretary of Defense attack the Pentagon in front of its people? To them I reply, I have no desire to attack the Pentagon. I want to liberate it.
Insurance scams and insider trading, electronic fraud and vulgar betrayal, missing money and evidence destroyed. There are at least 8.5 trillion reasons to investigate the money trail of 9/11. Curious, then, that the U.S. government's final word on the attacks, the 9/11 Commission report, concluded that the money trail was not worthy of investigation at all. In Chapter 5 of the report, the Commission noted, to date, the U.S. government has not been able to determine the origin of the money used for the 9/11 attacks. Ultimately, the question is of little practical significance. 9/11 was a crime, and as every detective knows, the first rule of criminal investigation is to follow the money. So why did the 9/11 Commission specifically reject this rule? The answers to 9/11 are not going to come from the suspects of the crime. Instead, it's up to investigators to continue to unearth the true evidence on the 9/11 money trail. Follow the money.
And again, you've just been listening to the second part of a show done by James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. And I highly recommend that you check out his website, corbettreport.com. He does brilliant research and puts together videos, articles, and podcasts with information that you won't find in the corporate media or in the foundation-controlled fake alternative media. And now, just a reminder that 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at radioforall.net, and that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, search for Cheryl under the letter C, and the show should pop up. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Right on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Mumia Must Live, an emergency report on the medical mistreatment of the world's most renowned political prisoner.
We move to a critical issue. In 1976, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that prisoners were entitled to the same medical and dental treatment as everyone else in their communities, and that prisons withholding treatment may be held liable for violating the U.S. Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. However, the reality is that we might never know how many prisoners have suffered or died from medical and health care neglect or willful mistreatment behind the walls.
But the case of journalist, world-renowned humanist, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, now in the fight for his life against the outrageous and deadly medical treatment in the prison system, is highlighting for the public the necessary fight to ensure that no more members of this vulnerable population suffer and are deprived of adequate health care, that the Supreme Court holding must be followed.
Mumia Must Live, an emergency report on the medical mistreatment of the world's most renowned political prisoner, with Esperanza Martel, peace and human rights activist who's worked on social issues dealing with Puerto Rico, independence, political prisoners, education, and health care for decades, and Joanna Fernandez with the campaign to bring Mumia home, who teaches 20th century U.S. history, the history of social movements, the political economy of American cities, and African-American history. Let's listen.
We need to be able to make a connection within the Black Lives Matter movement, that murder is the most extreme form of police violence, but police violence happens every day, and it puts innocent people in jail that then are sickened in prison by this horrific system. So what happens when young people are imprisoned? They're subjected to a daily diet that's high in carbs, in salt content. So because of the horrific diet that prisoners get, there are 80,000 prisoners that suffer from diabetes. They've been sickened by the system. 40% of prisoners in 2012 had chronic medical conditions, including asthma, cancer, heart disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes. Sitting on top of this medical crisis is a for-profit provider of medical care in the prisons, reaping an enormous amount of profits. They're making so much money because these medical providers are engaged in around-the-cost-cutting measures. They're trying to cut corners at every turn, not provide prisoners with the tests they need and the medication they need. At SCI Mahanoy, where Mumia is housed, the company is called Corizon Correctional Healthcare. Corizon Correctional Healthcare has had to pay out millions in legal settlements because it's been proven that they've killed people, bungled their treatment, and offered inadequate treatment. It's a system that disproportionately targets African Americans and Latino, poor people. It sickens them. This is a human rights crisis of epic proportion. In the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, we have a situation in which the state is deploying torture against a human being. Mumia's body is completely disfigured. His skin looks like elephant hide. He cannot sleep at night because he is in pain and he's scratching all night long, and he sleeps throughout the day. In March, Mumia fell into diabetic shock on March 30th. His blood sugar went up to 779. So diabetic coma registers at 800. He was in diabetic shock at 779, only points away from being in a near-death situation out of which he easily would not have awoken. Had it not been for Major Tillery, another prisoner, who went to the head of the prison, Carestes, and said, "Are you going to let this man die?" Mumia wouldn't be with us today. And at some point, Mumia recounted to me that he was heartened when he heard another prisoner stand up for him, because he couldn't do that for himself. The cost of that for Major Tillery was that he was transferred out of SCI Mahanoy and thrown in the hole in another prison for 3 or 4 months. And he was recently released from the hole because of a campaign we launched. So Mumia fell into diabetic shock with his blood sugar level registering at 779, but also, which is something that no one has inquired about, he had a sodium level of 168, which is, according to doctors, lethal. A salt level of 168 produces brain damage, apparently. Mumia survived. I visited Mumia just last Saturday because Pam got word from someone in the prison that Mumia's cell had been raided. And Mumia's body is disfigured, and he has lost 25 pounds in the last 2 months. He looked really weak.
Say how much he lost before.
Oh, and when he was in medical crisis, in that medical crisis, he lost 50 pounds in a very short span of time. So Mumia looks very weak. He was more lucid during the visit than I've ever heard him, but his body is very weak. You should know, because this is going to hit the news soon, Mumia cut his locks, all of them. He cut them himself with a clipper because they were falling out. This is important because Mumia's locks represent defiance. It represents move. It represents his politics. But Mumia is more than his hair. And he's ultimately fighting to survive, to make sure that the system doesn't get away with murder. Let me just give you a sense of what he told me. Mumia, as a result of this diabetic shock, had a swelling of the brain. He had encephalitis, which means that, so I asked him, so okay, you look better, you sound better and your face looks better, how are you doing? And he said, I've been through war, I've been through hell, but in the last 2 weeks I've been able to read again. Up until this moment, I've not been able to contain words in my brain. For me, that is devastating, because books have kept me alive, imprisoned. And people are continuing to ask me to produce and to write commentaries and to give talks. But in the past, I was able to do a commentary in my head in no time. I outlined the themes and then I wrote it up. And now it takes me a week to figure out how to put ideas together on a page. Once someone goes through a crisis that's that epic physically, it takes approximately a year for your body to respond. And it's been approximately 6 months since Mumia fell into diabetic shock. And Mumia is a fighter, so he's reading in half the time. What I want to convey is that the state has attempted to kill Mumia's body and Mumia's spirit, but they've not succeeded, because Mumia is reading and he's writing. He's going to come home. But we need to figure out how we are going to connect Mumia's case to the larger crisis of healthcare that is tantamount to torture and an international disaster, to connect that to the crisis of police brutality, violence, and murder, and we need to connect that to the Black Lives Matter movement. How we are going to convince the Black Lives Matter movement that freeing all political prisoners is the moral assignment of their generation. Because without the sacrifices that political prisoners made in the 1960s and 70s, the Black Lives Matter movement wouldn't exist. And I just want to let people know that Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal, in collaboration with activists in Philadelphia, and we're hosting a conference in Philadelphia, honoring Mumia and all political prisoners on the Black radical tradition. And we are involving the different groups in the Black Lives Matter movement with the objective of connecting the dots and connecting these issues and strengthening our movements. Because what your generation can bring to the emerging movements is experience and a holistic understanding of the problems of the society and the lessons of the past. So we need to pump this movement with connections, but also with creativity. That's the assignment for this moment. Mumia will be free. The possibility for Mumia's freedom will increase exponentially with the advancement of the Black Lives Matter movement. And this is not just about Mumia. This is about justice, overturning a system that's rotten to the core. This is about all political prisoners. A lot of people say, you know, this is not just about Mumia. But if today there is greater attention and more discussion of health in the prisons because of Mumia, because Mumia fell into crisis and this incredible movement went into overdrive, and there have been articles since this crisis on healthcare in the prisons, because if the most famous prisoner in the world can be treated so horribly and tortured, imagine what the system is doing to ordinary prisoners. That's why Mumia's case and his health is important. Because if Mumia gets treatment for hepatitis C, that will establish a precedent for the 10,000 other prisoners in Pennsylvania who are suffering for hepatitis C. That's why on Thursday, the DOC and SEI Mahanoy wrote back to our lawyers and said, no, he doesn't have, this isn't a hepatitis C situation. Because if they do acknowledge that it's hepatitis C, then they'll be forced to cure him, and then they'll be forced to cure everybody else. Because once the cat's out of the bag in Mumia's case, the entire world is going to shine a light on the broader crisis of healthcare in the prisons. The state has tried to execute him on numerous occasions, and it tried to do it again extra-legally, but we've won. We need to keep on fighting, and ultimately, Mumia is going to be cured when he comes home. And that's why we're here today.
Introducing Esperanza Martel, hearing her description of what happened with Pedro Albizu Campos, one of the great, great nationalist heroes of the Puerto Rican struggle that more of us should know more about. She was one of the youngest people doing political prisoner work, I don't know how many years back, been very active in the Puerto Rican struggle, currently in the 34 mujeres that have been organized for Oscar Lopez, and I want to welcome her.
I'm going to pass this book around, and it's Collector's Item, it's in Spanish, and it's I Accuse. So this is the author who did an expose on the torture and murder of Pedro Albizu Campos. And you will see pictures that look very similar to Mumia's body right now and his physical conditions. You need to read this book. You know, most people don't understand the struggle for liberation of Puerto Rico and the resistance and the torture of freedom fighters. So you really need to read this book. It also has pictures of Don Pedro and during the time of the torture. So I highly recommend that it reads like a novel. So read this book, really. So people say, how many years you've been doing this work? I started very young. I started in 1970. I have been doing this work. And it's real important to really understand. Not only have I been working on the freedom for Puerto Rican political prisoners, but also for all prisoners. Did a lot of work on the regular prison population around women in Rikers for a long time. So I know what's been going on for a long, long time. And when we think about prisoners and the tortures of prisoners, you need to begin during slavery. Because the prisons, the models that was established with the prisons came out of slavery. And the same horrendous torture that our people suffered in slavery, whether it was slavery under the English or the French or the Spanish, it is what people are still experiencing today. So it's not disconnected. So I want to take you to Puerto Rico in the early 1900s. The U.S. invaded Puerto Rico in 1898, and from that period on, there was a resistance, there was the fight back. There's a young boy named Pedro de Sus Campos from Ponce, and some Jesuit priests saw that he was brilliant, and eventually he ended up in Harvard University, got a law degree at Harvard, and a degree in economics. And in his 20s, right, young man, he traveled solo around Latin America because he had worked on the issues of liberation of the Irish. He started the first Irish club in Harvard, and then he went to Latin America where he took the issue of liberation of Puerto Rico all over Latin America. And he comes back in the 30s and he's organizing. He's organizing not only around the independence of Puerto Rico, but what became a real threat to the United States government is that he was organizing the sugar cane workers. Because we got displaced, Puerto Ricans got displaced. That's why there were so many Puerto Ricans in the United States. But Albizu was organizing sugarcane workers, tobacco workers, and he became a real threat. Fast forward to 1950, where there was a rebellion in Puerto Rico, an aborted attempt to take over the Puerto Rico back from the United States, and Albizu gets arrested. He had been arrested many times. Albizu spent about 30 years in U.S. prisons. But in 1950, he gets arrested. He's found guilty of the same thing Oscar was found guilty of, seditious conspiracy to overthrow the United States government, which is a thought crime, even though there were arms involved and people took over precincts and cities, and it was a revolutionary attempt. And he is put in prison in a very interesting name for a prison, La Princesa, the princess. It was a prison in Puerto Rico. And he experienced radiation. He says, I'm being radiated. Everybody says he's crazy, that it's not happening. This happened from 51 to 56. He's being radiated. And then there are movements in the United States, international movement, where they eventually have to release Albizu through the United Nations. I wanted to read to you how the United Nations defines torture. Because the case of Mumia right now is serious human rights violations. And we need to look at the Declaration of Human Rights and the Charter from the United Nations on torture. The way that we were able to get Albizu Campos released, even though it was 6 months before he died of radiation poisoning, once through the United Nations effort. That's what it was. A Mumia is even more challenging because he is in a state prison. He's not in a federal prison. So, and his offense is a state offense. But I still think that we could take on stopping, because this is about beyond a medical neglect. This, to stop the torture of Mumia and to stop the attempted murder of Mumia. That's what it's about. And it's really on us. And we have to figure out how we are going to take this to the United Nations, to take it to Geneva, right? To engage more international governments. I know that a few have been engaged already. The issues of prisoners and medical, in quotes, neglect, especially of political prisoners, is appalling. It's nothing new or novel. There are committees, many committees who are fighting against these things. But it gets worse and it gets worse. And now they're privatizing the prisons, and that's even going to be more horrendous for our peoples who are aging in prison. So, yes, this is all about Mumia, and it's not all about Mumia. This is about every prisoner who is in a U.S. jail. You know, we are big on Guantanamo. Well, guess what? Guantanamo is in the prison right next door. Okay? And they just practice in Guantanamo. So that's my call. That's my call today. And Oscar, who has spent 34 years in prison, was in solitary confinement for 12 years, right, is suffering, like every other prisoner, from some prison-induced illness. And I could go down the list, right? And we need to all stand up for them. So, in Puerto Rico, we say libertad o muerte. Here we say free the land, right? Free our land and free all political prisoners. Thank you.
From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Statement to supporters. I know that you've heard about my situation. And I can't thank y'all enough for your messages of love and support. Thanks to your love, I'm healing slowly. But I must tell y'all that the issue really isn't about Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's a system that claims the right to do what's wrong. Think of this. When's the last time you heard a doctor say, yeah, you're sick, but I won't treat you. Come back in a few years. You're not sick enough. Think of that. That's the position of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Imagine that. There are at least 10,000 men, and who knows how many women, in this state's prisons who have hepatitis C. 10,000. Now, I believe the number to be considerably more, by the way. For the vast majority of them, the state refuses to provide treatment, saying, not now. Doesn't that amaze you? And if it amazes you, it should also enrage you. It should move you, all of you, to organize. So I say, join us. Let us build a movement that opens the door to treating all that need it. So holler at our sister, Pan Africa. Let's build a movement that can't be ignored. I thank you all. With love, on the move, this is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Black Light by Abiodun Oyewale.
Mumia, you have gone beyond Job in the belly of the beast, locked in a cage like a bird, but somehow you seem to fly away. You're never really there where they want you. because you're with the people, living in their hearts, on their minds, and their lips. A brilliant black light, a brilliant black light, a brilliant black light in a white hole of pain. A brilliant black light, a brilliant black light, a brilliant black light in a white hole of pain. A brilliant black light, a brilliant black light in a white hole. Free freedom and let it replace the air that stifles our movements and makes dull our day. Free freedom, let's do the dance, harness the wind in our feet and step over the barbed wire that crowns our existence and rips at the heart of fate. Free freedom and let it sing loud from the rooftops of every project in America with the drums playing in the background. Freedom and Mumia have become one and the same. Mumia, you have gone beyond Job in the belly of the beast, locked in a cage like a bird, but somehow you seem to fly away. You're never really there where they want you, because you're with the people, living in their hearts, on their minds, and their lips. A brilliant black light in a white hole of pain. Mumia, you have gone beyond Job in the belly of the beast, locked in a cage like a bird, but somehow you seem to fly away. You're never really there where they want you. A brilliant black light in a white hole. A brilliant black light. Mumia, Mumia. A brilliant black light. Mumia. A brilliant black light. Mumia, 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 Mumia. Mumia, a brilliant black light. 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 A brilliant black light. A brilliant black light. A brilliant black light. A brilliant black light in a white hole of pain.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
If you're a rich white gay man of a dominant faith who has his full health and all kinds of other trappings of privilege, and you are a young person, a person of color, a person who's gender nonconforming, a person with health issues, you can be living in the same community and it's like you're living in different countries.
Something inside so strong.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Canada's Liberal Party landslide ushers in a second Trudeau era. Slovenia's High Court forces a referendum on marriage equality and outright counts global equality gains and losses. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 24th, 2015. Canadian voters made a sharp left turn in national elections on October 19th. The Liberal Party's Justin Trudeau, son of the charismatic former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, will replace deposed Conservative Party PM Stephen Harper after the Liberals won a 54% majority in Parliament. There were rumors in 2012, denied at the time, that some of Harper's more right-wing party members were actually floating the idea of repealing Canadian marriage equality. Trudeau is considered to be relatively progressive politically. He's described himself as a feminist and has been a strong advocate for LGBT rights. It also certainly hasn't hurt Trudeau's political career to be thought of by many women and men as a hunk. The Ottawa native is only 43 years old, which will make him the second youngest prime minister in Canadian history. He celebrates his 44th on Christmas Day. During his campaign, Trudeau pledged to introduce legislation to add gender identity to the Canadian Human Rights Act and to the hate crime provisions of the Criminal Code, and end a ban on blood and organ donations by gay people, which was actually expanded under Harper. It was a politically stunning comeback for the Liberal Party, which is actually more centrist. The minority NDP, New Democratic Party, is considerably more to the left. The Liberal Party won 184 seats in Parliament, a huge increase from the 36 they held after suffering their worst-ever election defeat to Harper's Conservatives in 2011.
In local Canadian election results of note, Randy Boissonneau was elected to represent Edmonton Centre in Parliament and will be Alberta's first openly gay MP, while Sherry Benson becomes the first out person from Saskatchewan elected to Parliament. According to social media postings, at least six out and proud members now have seats in the Canadian Parliament, matching the historic high of a decade ago. In an opinion piece for the well-respected Canadian Daily Extra, managing editor Robin Perel quotes journalist Rob Easton's celebration of the election's results, mixed with a good dose of skepticism about the future. I'm elated we no longer have those awful, awful people running the show here anymore. But let's not kid ourselves in thinking we've ushered in a new era, Easton cautioned. We must work harder to get a potentially more sympathetic ear to act on what really matters. Perel seemed to agree, writing that, I think it's a healthy place to be, however sincere our approachable and charming new minister may be.
In other news, Slovenia's constitutional court has ruled that it was illegal for lawmakers to reject a proposed voter referendum on marriage equality. The National Assembly passed sweeping legislation in March that redefined civil marriage in the Central European nation as a union of two consenting adults. Lawmakers argued that recent changes to the constitution prohibit referenda on human rights issues, so a majority rejected a subsequent motion by Roman Catholic Church-backed factions to put the issue to a public vote. Proponents had already gathered more than enough signatures to force a referendum, so they challenged the legislature's denial in the Constitutional Court. In clearing the way for a public vote, the High Court's 5-4 ruling on October 22nd seemingly ignored the constitutional question itself, deciding instead that the National Assembly had infringed on judicial territory and that only the Constitutional Court can decide constitutional issues. If more than 20% of the electorate participates in the referendum, a simple majority vote against the marriage equality law would lead to its repeal. The English language Slovenia Times noted that the marriage equality legislation passed earlier this year impacts about 70 different laws governing family matters. A prominent Slovenian LGBT rights activist tweeted that the High Court has essentially invited the community to inundate the courts with separate filings challenging each of those individual laws.
A law creating civil unions for same-gender and heterosexual couples took effect in also predominantly Roman Catholic Chile, and also on October 22nd, even as LGBT activists continue to push for full marriage equality in the South American nation. President Michelle Bachelet signed the civil unions law in April, but has also called for opening civil marriage to same-gender couples. The civil unions law offers some marital benefits, but falls far short of full marriage equality. Nevertheless, dozens of LGBT rights advocates gathered outside the Civil Registry and Identification Service office in Santiago to celebrate the civil unions law coming into force. Couples began arriving at civil registry offices across the country early in the day to officially validate their unions. As the Associated Press reported, some wore matching traditional Chilean cowboy garb, others elegant tuxedos and dresses. There were reports that as many as 1,500 couples registered on the first day. Roxana Ortiz and Virginia Gomez were among the celebrants in Santiago and became the first lesbian couple to register their civil union. Gomez told reporters that it was beautiful. It was all very emotional. Our families were here. Everyone was shedding tears. But Ortiz said that it was only a first step, adding that we are going to continue the fight for marriage equality.
Meanwhile, some lawmakers in Russia are proposing an expansion of the notorious law against gay propaganda to make it a crime just to come out publicly. According to reports in Newsweek and The Advocate, the new bill is being drafted as an amendment to the country's infamous ban on propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations, which imposes fines and censure for any person or agency making pro-LGBT statements in any venue that could be accessible to minors. The original legislation was drafted by members of President Vladimir Putin's ruling United Russia Party and was strongly supported by the nation's Orthodox Church. Both chambers of Russia's legislature passed the law unanimously. If the proposed amendment is signed into law, anyone who publicly declares a non-traditional sexual orientation could be fined 5,000 rubles, equivalent to about $80, for demonstrating their own expressed sexual preferences in public places. Making such a declaration in a school, cultural establishment, or government building could land the offender in jail for 15 days. Ivan Nikichuk, one of two communist lawmakers sponsoring the proposal, told the Russian state newspaper Izvestia that, in the biological sense, not reproducing is the same as death, and in that sense, homosexuality is a lethal threat for the whole of humankind.
And if you're planning to visit Indonesia, you might want to steer clear of the Aceh province. All its residents and even foreign tourists will now be punished by 100 strokes of a cane if they're caught engaging in same-gender sex. While Indonesia is the most populous Muslim nation on the planet, the vast majority practice a more moderate form of the faith, and private consensual adult same-gender sex is not illegal in the rest of the country. But harsh Islamic law, known as Sharia, rules Aceh. The province gained a degree of autonomy in a deal with Jakarta more than a decade ago, aimed at quelling a protracted separatist movement, and the government there has been slowly implementing Sharia ever since. The new regulations, passed in 2014, sparked outrage from human rights groups, so officials decided to hold off implementation until they thought the public had been sufficiently educated about it. Provincial Sharia chief Siarizal Abbas told Agence France-Presse that the purpose of the law, which came into force on October 23rd, is to safeguard human dignity. It is to protect Aceh's Muslims from committing immoral acts. Canings are carried out with thin rattan sticks in public and are aimed at humiliating rather than causing serious physical pain. Offenders who can afford it can opt out with payments of pure gold. Jail time is also an option.
But finally, in better news for LGBT people and their allies this week, the World Medical Association has issued new guidelines for the treatment of transgender people that condemn any effort to cure them. Transgender is not a disorder, the guidelines emphasize, saying that each person has a fundamental right to define her or his own gender, and that every effort should be made to make individualized, multiprofessional, interdisciplinary, and affordable transgender healthcare. The Global Doctors Group is based in France, and according to Wikipedia, is a consortium of more than 100 national medical associations, ranging from Cuba to Nigeria to the United States, and represents more than 10 million physicians worldwide. The new guidelines were proposed by the German Medical Association. Meeting in Moscow this week, delegates to the association's annual conference also resolved that new medical professionals need to receive appropriate training for treating transgender patients without bias. The group's president, Sir Michael Marmot, said in a statement that, "We condemn all forms of discrimination, stigmatization, and violence against transgender people and want to see appropriate legal measures to protect their equal civil rights. As role models, physicians should use their medical knowledge to combat prejudice in this respect."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 24th, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Brothers and sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough, what do we do then? We'll look them in the eyes and say, we're going to do it anyway.
We're going to do it anyway.
You've probably flirted with this song, but did you know it was in another relationship? Find out if it's really an unfaithful anthem later in the program.
There are certain LGBTI communities that are experiencing legal recognition and resources and safety unlike anything our community has ever seen in the history of the world. And then at the same time, you're seeing these catastrophic blows that are introducing old forms of criminalization and coming up with entirely new categories.
Difficult situations and scattered successes are part of the normal workload for Outright International Executive Director Jessica Stern. In the conclusion of her two-part conversation with Steve Pride that began last week, Stern talks more about how her group, which was formerly known as the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC, addresses global movement concerns, including the positive notes.
Lesbian, gay, or bisexual identity may mean something different from country to country or culture to culture, right?
In the U.S., we could spend hours probably just on the question of language. What is our chosen identity versus the formal language we use to describe ourselves? Imagine trying to discuss those complexities at the international level. We use the framework of international human rights law to guide a lot of what we do. So we talk in terms of freedom from discrimination and violence based on actual or perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, and bodily status. And we talk about that because we're trying to capture a lot of local nuance. So here we may say transgender, but in parts of Southeast Asia, they might say Meti or Hijra. When I first started doing this work in Southern Africa, where we were saying dyke or trans in my community in Brooklyn, they were talking about lesbian men. So language varies radically from place to place. We work with partners across Africa. We hear and respond more and more to those that see intersex rights as a crucial part of our movement and as a new frontier where there's a lot more we can do. So we're talking not only about LGBT rights, but LGBTI rights.
So you flee your homophobic country. Where do you go? What's the situation around the world for LGBTI asylum seekers?
There's a spectrum. Some countries are better than others. If a friend of mine needed to seek asylum or become a refugee and they were fleeing persecution based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, more than likely I would suggest they go to Sweden, where there's actually ways to have legal status, there's ways to work, there's ways to receive a government stipend while you're waiting. There are systems to support asylum seekers and refugees that I think, for instance, exceed what we offer here in the U.S. But even there, it's incredibly hard. We start from the premise that no one should ever have to leave home. And I know from doing this work for going on 20 years that, frankly, no one ever wants to leave home. The last thing you want to have to do is pick up your life, move to another country where you know no one, maybe face xenophobia, maybe face racism, have to learn a different language, and basically have to start your life again. That said, some people do have to flee. And it is the obligation of the global community to support those people. So I think whether we're talking about the U.S. or Sweden or any country you can possibly imagine, there's much more we should be doing for asylum seekers and refugees.
But how do you prove you're gay or lesbian?
The way of proving that you faced persecution based on your sexual orientation or gender identity is incredibly complicated and depends on either being able to prove that you were out and you therefore faced persecution, or somehow being able to prove that you are something. And how do you prove that you are something if you lived in an oppressive place and you weren't allowed to be out? Some asylum seekers and refugees, particularly in the UK, are driven to such desperation that they've started filming themselves having sex as a way to prove, quote unquote, that they're queer, which is a level of degradation and dehumanization that is just astounding.
The horrific flip side of proving yourself gay is governments, such as Egypt, trying to prove men gay via rectal exams.
The notion that rectal exams have a place in the world to quote-unquote prove homosexuality is, unfortunately, it's a more widely held belief than you would imagine could possibly be true. From a human rights perspective, forced anal exams designed to prove homosexuality are not only based on false science and misunderstandings of both the body and sex, but they also amount to violations of people's privacy, and they amount to acts of torture. Because in many instances, when these tests are performed, they are done to dehumanize and they are done with violence. So one of the things that I'd like to see on my wish list is the abolition of forced anal exams as a means of testing for homosexuality in every country around the world.
Let's talk about media. How do journalists get it wrong?
I think culturally we're all drawn to sensation. So we focus on the car accident. We focus on the tree falling over and crashing into a car. We focus on the horror stories. And I don't know about you, Steve, but I couldn't do the work that we do for LGBT rights without also seeing the good and the ways our community is successfully making change. So I'm really celebrating right now the fact that in Malta of all places, a small conservative Catholic country, passed this heroic law that follows an example set by Argentina in having the best possible standards for gender identity recognition in the world, which says your gender is determined by how you identify. You do not have to undergo any form of bodily modification, and your gender is determined by your own knowledge, your own experience. You don't need someone to medicalize you to say who you are. So Malta not only did that, but it also introduced new legal precedents for recognition of intersex people. And it has this gorgeous language that basically says, everyone has the right to a gender identity. And it's really quite stunning. So I wish more people were looking at Malta, which has in recent years gone from having almost no laws recognizing LGBT rights to having some of the best in the world. And we are very active in a campaign with a range of community groups in the Philippines pushing for a federal non-discrimination law. The fight has been going on for, believe it or not, 16 years, but the community in the Philippines has a real chance of getting a federal non-discrimination law by the end of 2015.
So what's the best and the worst place to live if you're LGBTI?
Whenever someone asks this question, depending upon the day, the month, the year, I could answer it in a million different ways, but I always come back to the same concept. The laws on the books are just one part of the story. the reality of how you live and whether you have support from your family, whether you can go to work free of discrimination, free of fear, whether you can walk down the street by yourself or with your partner without having to look over your shoulder and see if you're going to get jumped. That is something that cannot easily be defined. So I would say there is no best place on earth. There is no worst place on earth. I think we are always in the process of trying to assert our rights and reach a higher standard. The worst place on earth to be LGBTI is where you're unsafe. The best place to be LGBTI is where you have all of the things that make you feel validated, that make you feel that your dignity is respected. It's where you have home, where you have family, where you have friends and work and political participation. And I wish I could say there was that queer nirvana. I wish I could say I knew where that was. But I think for all of us, it's just home. It's what we're trying to do in our local communities and in solidarity with other people. And if you're a rich white gay man of a dominant faith who has his full health and all kinds of other trappings of privilege, and you are a young person, a person of color, a person who's gender nonconforming, a person with health issues, you can be living in the same community and it's like you're living in different countries because your safety and security and your rights and your benefits don't look the same.
A storm is threatening my very life today. If I don't get some shelter, oh yes, I'm gonna fade away. Whoa, children, it's just a shot away. It's just a shot away. Whoa, children, it's just a shot away.
Steve Pride interviewed Jessica Stern, Executive Director of Outright Action International. You can find out more at outrightinternational.org.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller
I become.
Farther you take my rights away, faster I will. Something inside so strong, I know that I can make it. Though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, there's something inside so strong.
Something inside so strong.
Something inside so strong.
As sung by the Flirtations at the 1993 March on Washington for LGBT rights, Something Inside So Strong became known to much of the West as a classic queer anthem, never realizing that it was penned in 1987 by South African musician Labi Sifra. Sifra revealed last week that the song that at the time rallied the anti-apartheid movement was actually inspired by his experiences as a gay man. Here he is in his own words.
The more you refuse to hear my voice, the louder I will sing. You hide behind walls of Jericho. Your lies will come tumbling. Deny my place and time. You squander wealth that's mine. My light will shine so brightly it will blind you. Because there's something inside so strong. Yeah. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no. There's something inside so strong. And sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough, well, we know better. Look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway. 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 That my pride was gone. Oh no, there's something inside so strong.
Lobby Sifra's first live performance in 16 years is set for November 8th at Leicester Square Theatre in London. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V, Tanya Kane Perry, Roberta Kaplan, and Steve Pride contributed program material. The Tom Robinson Band, Rosalind Williams from the multi-artist Playing for Change, The Flirtations, and Lobby Sifra performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, our social media links, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on KZYX Fort Bragg, California, WRUW Cleveland, Ohio, BCFM Bristol, England, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, Humans seem to be at war with nature, epitomized by the system of capitalism, which plunders as it grows. But what if we understood the realm of nature as not separate from the human realm of society? I'm Sasha Lilly. Radical scholar Jason Moore suggests that we need to embed our critique of capitalism within the web of life on Earth, so as best to oppose it. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Whether we're radical ecologists or mainstream economists or just members of the public, we tend to think of capitalism as an economic system, one that many of us believe is laying waste to the environment. But what if, as Jason W. Moore suggests, capitalism is not outside of nature? Corporations, he argues, are as much part of the environment as rainforests. Wait, before you conclude that this lets capitalism off the hook, it should be said that what Moore is suggesting is the opposite, that anti-capitalists would be best served by recognizing that capitalism is a system of organizing nature and that nature plays an active role in the process. Through such a lens, he posits, we can realize that the myriad crises of our time, the financial crisis, the food crisis, and the climate crisis, amongst others, are all part of the same crisis. Moore makes such an argument in his book, Capitalism in the Web of Life, Ecology and the Accumulation of Capital, published by Verso. He's an environmental historian and political economist and teaches in the sociology department at SUNY Binghamton. Jason, welcome back to the program. I'd like to begin by asking you to characterize how ecologists, and those of us in the general public more broadly, tend to think of the environment and our relationship to it.
It's a funny thing because on one level, what we learn as we grow up in schools, in universities, in environmentalist politics, for the most part, is we learn to think of nature as out there. There's society. Society is full of culture, of economies, of cities, of things that humans make. And then we learn to think about nature as outside of that. And so we create this box that we call nature, and then we create another box that we call society. So we have society with humans without nature, and we have nature, environments without humans. And then in the way that we learn to think about this, the two interconnect. They sort of interact and collide with each other and then influence each other. And at the same time, we know that we are always connected with and within the web of life, that we are a species that evolved on this planet, that we have particular capacities to shape other life on this planet, and that in doing so, we shape our own histories, so that we are very deeply connected. When we think about the food we eat, the cars we drive, the computers we use, we are at every moment intimately and immediately connected within this vast web of life, that is nature as a whole. And one of the things that I did with this book is people ask me, well, what is the web of life? Why do you call it capitalism in the web of life? And I say simply that people think they know what nature means. When you say nature, they go to the climate, the forests, the soils, the rivers and the waters. And it is all of that. And it also includes stock markets and industrial systems and credit systems and ways of building cities. These two are all ways of making the web of life. And so part of what this book tries to do is speak to this deeper intuition that many of us have that says, you know, humans are a part of nature, and that means also that nature is within us. And part of what I do in this book is I give a series of conversations. There are four different conversations in this book, and they are conversations because I am essentially asking, well, what happens if instead of saying or presuming that humans are separate from nature, if we presume the opposite, that humans are always connected within the web of life? And so what I do in this book, which is in some ways In some ways, it's a scholarly book. In other ways, it's a book that really aims to talk to a much broader audience to say, well, what happens to our imagination, to our politics, to the ways that we describe and interpret the world around us and how it came to be? What happens if we presume that we are already part of the web of life?
Well, one of the questions I think that brings up for people is, but wait a minute, if you're not separating society from nature, if you're not seeing humans as distinct in some way from nature, then how can we understand the damage that we are doing to the natural world, even let's just say the rest of the natural world? And that, of course, is at the heart of green thought, right? That's one of the fundamental premises of environmental thinking.
That's right. Perhaps the central idea of environmentalist thought, and I want to say that I'm a huge admirer, that really my work builds off of this tradition. The central claim in some ways is a powerful moral claim that modernity or capitalism or industrialization does terrible things to environments. Now, that's exactly right. It does do terrible things to environments. And as we know, it does terrible things to the living creatures, humans included, who are on those environments. So the question is, how do we bring those two moments together? And I think also that we need to recognize that, yes, of course, humans are distinctive. Humans have remarkable capacities for using language and symbols to build extraordinary forms and often devastating forms of social cooperation that are truly remarkable, that allow us to forge a collective memory, that allow us to engage in massive projects as a species. And what I say is that the distinctiveness of humans is, in fact, obscured by a dualist framework, a framework that says there are humans over here in one box that we'll call society, and there's nature over in another box without humans. That the distinctiveness of humans is in putting nature to work in various ways, extraordinary ways. If we think about the history of the modern world, it has been built on cheap nature, that is, on taking for very low cost or practically free the unpaid work, not just of environments in the ways that we usually think of this. So we can think of coal or oil or forests or fertile land to grow cash crops on. Not just that unpaid work, but also the unpaid work of the vast majority of the world, of the vast majority of humanity, women, nature, and colonies, in Maria Mies's great turn of phrase. So until we put together a picture that says the relations of power and creativity and destruction and everything else that humans forge with each other is linked to the rest of nature, then we're going to be left with a kind of vocabulary that is this environmentalist adjectival promiscuity. Like there's environmental justice and social justice. There's an environmental proletariat and a social proletariat. There's environmental imperialism and social imperialism. I would say no, that we need to look for how those moments are always already connected with each other. Imperialism and justice are always about whose lives matter and which parts of nature matter and which parts of nature don't matter. So that's part of what this book tries to open up without presuming that I have all the answers. I essentially engage in a series of thought experiments grounded in the history of the modern world to say, well, what would that look like? What are the possibilities?
You were talking about green thought and how environmentalist thinking thinks about these relationships. You mentioned the word capitalism, but before we get to that, which we will be talking about very extensively in this hour, I want to ask you about what problems that you see around the use in environmentalist thinking of the term humanity, beyond situating humanity squarely within nature.
The problem with how humanity is often used in environmentalist thinking is that it begins with a premise that on the one hand seems totally reasonable, and on the other hand is quite a violent process, that humanity is in one sense a whole, that we are a species, and I do believe we are all interconnected at some level, even if it is difficult to name that level, that we are all interconnected. On the other hand, if we want to understand the history of how we have arrived at this moment in 2015, an era of runaway climate change, of mass extinction, of the acidification of the oceans, of resource wars worldwide, of everything. We could multiply that list. If we want to understand that process, we have to understand that humanity in the modern world over the past five centuries or so is divided very powerfully along lines of race, class, gender, and other ways that if we begin by assuming that humanity is a collective actor, we end up with a story that I think doesn't give us the full picture of how we arrived at this point in time, that it's not simply a history of fossil fuel use or of steam engines and internal combustion engines or industrialization. It's a story of how one small group of humans in this world that we would call capitalists, those people who own the money and the means of production and have tremendous influence over what states and empires do, that how that group has come to dominate this world today, and how the profound questions of inequality of wealth and power are directly, immediately, and intimately linked to the questions of climate change and mass extinction and all the rest. So until we can put together those questions, the class question, the question of difference, and the question of nature, until we can put all of those together, we are going to have a limited understanding and a limited politics.
That's the voice of Jason Moore. He is the author of Capitalism in the Web of Life, which we're discussing today. That's published by Verso. He's an environmental historian and political economist. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So, Jason, you have been talking about why you see this division between nature on the one side and society as on the other as being an unuseful, at best, way of trying to understand not just our relationship with the rest of the world, but actually in some very fundamental way, understanding capitalism. And I guess what I wanted to ask you was, what do you see as the real benefit of seeing things this way, since this is such an important premise to your work, beyond what some might see as simply some kind of philosophical hair splitting?
Absolutely. To go back to this question of humanity and who counts as human with a capital H and who counts as nature, this was fundamental to the rise of capitalism in the age of Columbus. That in those centuries between the 15th and the 18th centuries, it wasn't just the rise of cash cropping, the generalization of a world market, the formation of modern states and empires, and all the other things we commonly associate with capitalism. It wasn't just a technical or an economic process. It was bound up in the most intimate ways with the creation of this human with a capital H, nature with a capital N divide. And when we say that, we need to be aware that the history of the emergence of that divide between humanity with a capital H and nature with a capital N was a history of moving most of the people, most of the humans who lived under capitalist rule in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century from the category of humans into the category of nature. So in this period, African slaves were not part of humanity. They were part of nature. Indigenous peoples in the Americas were not part of humanity. They were part of nature. The Spaniard's word for indigenous peoples in colonial Peru was naturales. It included almost all European women who were not part of society or humanity. They too were part of nature, as Carolyn Merchant has shown us so long ago. So part of what I'm saying is that this is not merely a feel-good philosophy that we can say, oh, humans are a part of nature, that we need to look at how all these big binaries of race, of gender, and we could go down the list, really, in some sense, find their taproot in the nature-society divide. and this categorical distinction where, you know, humanity goes over here in one box and nature on the other. And that was a practical tool for the reorganization of land and labor, production and reproduction in the development of capitalism. And that is crucial because the rise of capitalism turned on appropriating the unpaid work of the vast majority of humans within the orbit of capitalist power. So Africans, indigenous peoples, women were all put in the category of nature. Why? So that they could be made into cheap nature in support of profitability in the market economy. And so this completely inverts how we usually think of capitalism. We say, oh, capitalism, that's an economic system, right? And I say, that's much too limited. We need to understand how capitalism over the past five centuries has survived by turning the unpaid work of humans and of extra human natures, of forests and soils and coal and oil, into a source for advancing profitability and productivity within a very limited sphere of the market. So in this sense, the story of the modern world becomes a story of islands of market life and market exchange and production within oceans of unpaid work and unpaid energy.
It sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, what you're arguing here is that capitalism functions by restructuring nature. The very provocative statement you made earlier that we should even think of stock markets as part of the natural world in some way, a reorganization of nature, and that capitalism is not a narrowly economic system, but actually a way of restructuring nature in the broadest sense. And yet the self-image of capitalism is that it is an economic system narrowly defined and that nature is on the outside. So in effect, would it be fair to say that green thought, which puts nature on the one hand and society on the other, is unconsciously echoing the self-image of capitalism itself, an image which is not accurate to how capitalism actually functions?
That's beautifully said, Sasha. That's absolutely right. And I hesitate to say it in those words because I do appreciate and have benefited and have made and am able to make the arguments that I'm making today because green thought really has laid out a whole rich history of culture and philosophy and economics and markets and empires. It really has laid out this rich historical and empirical terrain that makes it possible for me to say, well, you took that model as far as it can go. Now what? So yes, exactly that. To use the nature-society binary and to treat these two categories as if they are real is essentially to adopt the mentality of capitalism, is to engage and indulge and reproduce this conceit that says, well, there's social relations that form social relations of power and production and everything else that form independently of the web of life, and then here's nature outside of those. And that's exactly right, that in some sense, radical thought around environmental change, and never mind mainstream thought, has very much taken these categories for granted. Now, it's true that over the past 25 years, and we can think of extraordinary pioneers like Donna Haraway and Bruno Latour, that there has been a consistent and sustained critique of that view that humans and nature are separate. And what I'm trying to do is to take those powerful and profound philosophical and cultural insights onto the terrain of world history, because I say, well, we can't understand the nature of the crisis today unless we understand its historical development. And that means that we need to understand that capitalism isn't an economic system. It's not a social system. It is a way of organizing nature. And that way of organizing nature is not a one-way road. It's a two-way street. That, yes, capitalism produces the web of life, but the web of life also produces capitalism. That the relationship of history and capitalism is one example, but we could use others. The relationship of history is a co-productive one. And I have a term for this that is maybe ungainly, but I haven't found a better one. I call this the double internality. Yes, capitalism is inside of nature, but also nature as a whole is inside of capitalism. And that's an uneven relationship. But basically what I'm saying is that every time we think of a big relation of power or economy or culture, we need to look to see how those human relations are bundled, are intimately connected within parts of nature, and vice versa. So it's a kind of thought exercise that breaks us out of this common sense that we've all inherited, I certainly did, that humans are outside of nature and we should look at human relations independently of that.
Okay, but could you give us an example, because some of this may be a bit mind-bending to some listeners, when you talk about nature producing, co-producing capitalism and capitalism co-producing nature, and you do make the caveat that relationship is an uneven one, but can you give us an example of what you mean when we think of nature co-producing capitalism?
Absolutely. So if we look at the history of energy, the immediate tendency is to look at fossil fuels, first coal and then oil, as these external sources of power that were somehow discovered and then were put to work in these steam engines or internal combustion engines, and that transformed the world. So in the words of John McNeill, coal transformed the world. And what I would say, and what I've argued in relation to climate change and what's called the Anthropocene, which translates literally to age of man, make of that what you will, is that leads us into a dead end. If you think that coal and steam engines are the problem, then the answer is to go and shut down steam engines. But if you look at the relations of power and production and reproduction that made the steam engine, then you need to look at those relations of inequality and difference and power in a different way. You need to look at these relations of power as they flow through the web of life. So the rise of capitalism was made possible by a series of overlapping transformations that had to do with the scientific revolution, revolutions in making maps, revolutions in building modern empires with modern bureaucracies or something that began to look like those. And then, of course, also the story of stock markets and technical change and all of that. The secret of this process that has been hidden because of the separation between humanity and nature, the secret of all of those processes is that they were so powerful, they literally made the world that we live in a powerful sense. We still live in 1492. The secret of those processes is that they were all designed or oriented towards turning parts of nature, including human nature, that were outside markets into cheap nature that could then serve the power of empires or the labor productivity of industrial centers or the stock markets of the time. People forget about this, but in the 17th century on the Amsterdam stock market, 400 different primary commodities were traded. There were derivatives. This was very much a familiar process to us today after the financial crises of 2008, that this was a way of seeing world money and world nature as fundamentally connected. So if we understand that the project of capitalism isn't primarily even about turning things into commodities, but is only partially about turning things into commodities and largely about finding ways to turn the rest of reality that's outside of the market into cheap nature, we begin to have a much more powerful view of things. So if we return to the example of coal and the Industrial Revolution, yes, there's no doubt about it. The intersection of coal and steam power was gigantic. But in fact, coal mining begins in this era of the rise of capitalism in the 1530s, and it was not the only cheap energy source. There was peat in the Low Countries. There were forests across Europe. Let's remember that a lot of Europe was a third world country, like Poland in the 17th century and Brazil in the 17th century. It was a process of finding parts of nature to put to work for this weird and dynamic and audacious and destructive system, the capitalist market system, without falling prey to the idea that capitalism is just a market system.
Right. And so I wonder if you could just flesh out what you've really just touched on, which is, in essence, your definition of capitalism. How do you define it, and why do you locate it where you do?
Capitalism is a way of organizing nature, and it is premised on a very weird logic: endless economic growth. Okay, we know that up to a point. Yes, that's that, but it's so much more than economic growth in the way that we think about it. Capitalism is a way of accumulating wealth in a very particular way. That is, in taking essentially abstract human labor. If you think of all the activities of all the humans who are producing commodities in the world, and then you average out their labor time, that's essentially what determines the wealth of the system. That's what we call capital. Now, that's an old Marxist story. And I think that there's an important kernel of truth to that we ought to keep. We also need to bring in the feminist and the environmentalist critique, which says essentially, the feminist critique says that capitalism's way of valuing work systematically excludes all the work of what's called social reproduction, of raising families and making communities and doing all of that. The environmentalist critique says quite correctly, hey, look, nature does a bunch of work. If you think about the ecosystem services discourse, it's a very conservative discourse, but they say something very important. They say extra human nature works for human society. And that's a valuable insight. So both the feminist and the environmentalist perspectives are saying, okay, this Marxist view of labor productivity is much too narrow. And what I'm saying is they're all too narrow. But if you put them into conversation with each other, if you understand that the Marxist idea of labor productivity is connected in the most intimate and direct ways with the feminist position on the unpaid work of women and others in domestic labor, and the environmentalist perspective of saying, hey, nature does a bunch of work too, then we can begin to have a holistic and, I think, an adequate view of how we've come to this crisis today. And I think that it informs politics in some powerful ways. I think that it speaks to the urgency of linking together the spheres of commodity production, of industrial production, of services, of office work, of all of that, with the domain of social reproduction, and those two domains with the question of nature as a whole. And so I think if we look at the possibilities that are in front of us in terms of contemporary politics and movements for social and ecological justice, I think that's where many of them are headed, and I've certainly drawn inspiration from them.
Jason W. Moore is my guest today. We'll return with him in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Jason W. Moore. He teaches at the Sociology Department at Binghamton University and is an environmental historian and political economist. His new book is Capitalism in the Web of Life, Ecology and the Accumulation of Capital, published by Verso. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. We've been speaking about the way that you have come to understand capitalism. And I wanted to ask you, since one of the things that you are arguing in this book, Capitalism in the Web of Life, is that radicals, to get a handle on capitalism, need to constantly situate it historically in a global context. So bearing that historical thrust in mind, how have changes in the system, that is, the system of capitalism, taken place over time? How do you understand that?
Every era of capitalism reinvents the relations between humans and the rest of nature. And that occurs through violence and force, in part. That's the history of empires. It occurs through scientific revolutions, of discovering and in a lot of ways creating new possibilities of putting nature to work. And the way that I talk about this, and I hope this doesn't sound like academic hair splitting, because I think it's quite relevant to our politics. The way I talk about this is historical nature, that we need to understand that the historical nature that we live in today, in 2015, is distinct in a number of ways from the historical nature of, say, the 17th century, when the Dutch, believe it or not, were the superpowers of the time. That in the 17th century, there was a significantly different way of knowing the world, of being able to map the world. There was a different climate. There was a different set of connections between humans and the rest of nature that obtained over planetary life, but especially in the centers of wealth and power in early modern Europe. And so I say this because for the past 40 years, since we've had this very robust environmentalist thought, and we've had this extraordinary, really an embarrassment of riches of environmentally oriented scholars going out and studying everything, cities and colonialism and the World Bank and literature and everything else. We have this enormous wealth of knowledge about what has happened between humans and the rest of nature, and we still use this concept of nature in general. So, and nature in general doesn't help us see the dynamic and co-productive relations between capitalism or some of the processes like financialization or processes like cultural globalization and the rise of the internet over the past 30 years. It doesn't help us understand that there's a co-productive moment in which, yes, humans make historical nature, but also historical nature as a whole is making us. So the matter of climate change comes in. Yes, capitalism has driven us to the precipice of runaway global warming. There's no question about that. And what we need to understand is that at every moment through that process, global warming has been shaping our lives. And it's a nonlinear process. So we've seen some of the impacts, but as we know, the impacts are going to be much bigger, and they're really woven into the daily and weekly and annual processes of remaking and reproducing life on this planet. And so what I'm trying to say through this language of co-production and saying every social relation is bundled with parts of the rest of nature is to really change how we're thinking and how we're talking about these processes, that I think that once we understand that nature has a history and that humans are a part of that, that gives us some intellectual tools to forge a different world. And that we understand that the limits that we're facing today are not somehow imposed by nature with a capital N. The limits of our times are forged through this co-productive relation between historical capitalism in this moment in 2015 and historical nature in this moment. And if we don't have a very keen sense of how those two moments are fitting together, of how, say, climate and world agriculture and inequality and sustainability are all fitting together at this moment, then we're going to end up with a very limited vision and a limited politics.
Okay, so bearing in mind then that the crises of today, you're saying, are connected, and crises historically have also been connected, that they haven't just been in these discrete spheres of economy and environment and so on. How should we understand the crises of capitalism in the past? I will ask you about in the present in a moment, but how should we understand how capitalism has dealt with crises in the past? Because obviously it has throughout its entire history.
Capitalism has overcome its really great and fundamental crises in the past by finding new ways to secure and appropriate cheap nature, to appropriate what I call the four cheaps, of which one is human labor. and the others are food, energy, and raw materials. So if we look at the era of the Industrial Revolution, this is poorly understood. This was an era between about 1750 and 1820 of profound agrarian crisis on both sides of the Atlantic, in Europe, but also in the Americas. And that classical political economy, people like David Ricardo, were in fact deeply terrified that rising food prices would undermine industrialization and that would be the end of capitalism. Well, as we know, it was not the end of capitalism, and that the crises of this period in the 18th century were generated by the tremendous achievements of conquering and putting nature to work on a planetary scale of the three centuries or so after Columbus. And that's an extraordinary story, and its story was one of putting humans and the rest of nature to work for very free or low cost. By the 18th century, the possibilities for doing that, for putting nature to work, including human nature to work for free or low cost, were beginning to contract. So it was becoming harder and harder to get nature to work for free. And what happened, part of this is a story of coal and steam power. What happened is that a variety of technical and scientific and imperial innovations were developed to get nature to work cheaper and cheaper. So coal is huge in the story, but let's remember that England never fed itself, not for another century or more after 1800. It never was agriculturally self-sufficient. It drew its food from America, and North America was not built on coal. It was built through canals and on the frontier, which of course involved recategorizing indigenous peoples in North America as part of nature and therefore subject to all the resource management of expulsion and genocide that the new American state could muster. So this frontier process is central to how capitalism has worked. And in fact, there is no way for capitalism to get out of its contemporary bind today because the frontiers are getting smaller and smaller because we do live on a finite planet. And the pile of money that has to be invested profitably, the capital that is accumulated, is becoming larger and larger. So there's a disjuncture. Coal worked not just because it was a powerful energy source, but because it could be linked to the steamship to railroads to open up all of planetary nature to capitalist enterprise. And so it's true that what we saw over the next two centuries, really between 1800 and 2000, was an extraordinary boom that was in part made possible through coal and the steam engine. But that's a much too limited story because the technologies never do anything by themselves. The technologies don't explain how European powers built railways around the world, sent gunboats up the rivers in Africa to impose colonial rule. They don't explain power. Power explains the technologies. And that's what we have to understand. That's another powerful binary that we have that's a close cousin to nature society is that of technology and economy and technology and history.
Jason Moore is my guest, author of Capitalism in the Web of Life, Ecology and the Accumulation of Capital. I'm Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Jason, you are arguing what makes the crises of our time different than earlier crises that capitalism as a system has faced is that there are not obvious ways out of finding cheap sources of nature to deal with the crises, and you focus, just to reiterate, on four crucial cheap inputs, to use the dry and narrow economic term: energy, labor, power, food, and raw materials. As you say, capitalism has in the past managed to run up against these sort of obstacles and get around them. Would it not be possible, a little hard to imagine right now, given how myopic the capitalist class, at least in this country, is around renewable energy, but wouldn't it in theory be possible that infinite power of the sun could be harnessed as a new kind of cheap nature, both as energy but in other forms as well?
That's a great question, and it's one that's come up a lot in my dialogues with Christian Parenti, who is making this argument, I think, to great effect, that in fact, from some rational perspective, it would be completely feasible to solarize the world economy. And it would be completely feasible, we believe, many people believe, to build carbon removal technologies that would at least significantly address the problem of CO2 concentrations. I think that that brings us to a fundamental irrationality of capitalism, that capitalism's rationality is in some powerful sense premised on getting cheap natures to work for free or low cost. And I think that what we're looking at today is some kind of break with that rationality, because yes, hypothetically, it would be possible to solarize the world economy. Why it isn't happening, I think we need to get deeper into the questions of how world money and world power fit together. I think that the financial mania of the past 3 to 4 decades, this process of financialization, has deeply and profoundly fragmented the rulers of the world, to put it glibly, and fragmented their vision and their capacity for advancing some broadly socially progressive vision, even if it excluded many people, that there's no possibility for within this current framework to deal with these big planetary problems, because I think for all the talk about global power and global change, and we all live in a global world, I think that there is amongst the people who wield significant power a kind of almost unprecedented myopia in terms of any kind of broad-based social vision. Why that is vexing, and I don't know that I have a great answer for that. I can say that we have not seen a significant move that seems promising towards sustainable energy. We've seen the agrofuels revolution, which has at best sort of added a bit of energy at tremendous human and ecological cost. We've seen the ongoing effects of climate change on world agriculture. A lot of people talk about energy, but and energy and food, of course, are tightly related in terms of the fertilizer complex. But the world food system has been faltering in its capacity to deliver the kind of rising productivity gains that capitalism was really built on. Not just the Green Revolution of the 60s and 70s, but a whole long history of green revolutions across the centuries. So there are some, we can point to this kind of irrationality, and I can't help but think that it has to do with a kind of fundamental disconnect at the core of the kinds of markets that we have in this world that are premised on this illusion that markets can do everything and that markets are somehow separate from nature and can somehow manage this external nature. When we look at the track record, it's not strong, even on capitalism's own terms. And in fact, I think the faltering productivity of world agriculture over the past 3 decades, especially the rising cost of production in world money, in world energy, the rising cost of production in world resources, raw material production. It's a story that doesn't give us a lot of optimism for the revival of capitalism.
Well, how should we understand that in political terms? So what you are, in effect, arguing is that the crisis that what it seems like all of us, but capitalism, is facing right now, to use the language that you use in Capitalism in the Web of Life, is an epical crisis versus the developmental crises where the system butts up against an obstacle and then finds a way of going around it, often actually unleashing a kind of new round of accumulation. An epical crisis is one where the system can't kind of get beyond that point. And so what does that actually mean in political terms? Does that mean, you know, collapse? Does that mean a sort of static spinning? How do you understand that when you talk about an epical crisis?
So, well, you said it perfectly. there are two big kinds of crisis that capitalism could face. One is the historical record of what I call developmental crises. So there are periodic crises of long periods of development, such as we saw at the end of the post-World War II golden age in the 1970s, where you had rising prices for the four cheaps, rising prices for labor, food, energy, and raw materials. Now, as we know, that was quickly resolved over the span of a decade through a new debt regime and through a new alignment of world power where the United States and its allies pursued what's called the Washington Consensus, essentially a neoliberal prescription of deregulation, privatization, of dispossession, and so forth. The other kind of crisis is something that we've seen many civilizations go through. Feudal Europe experienced an epical crisis in the 14th century. If we could magically transport ourselves to, say, Paris in 1304, and we were having this conversation, Sasha, one could plausibly say, look, feudalism is this extraordinarily dynamic civilization. We have all these cities that are built, cathedrals, world trade, agricultural productivity, and on and on and on and on. And yet within 50 to 60 years, the major structures of power of the church and the agricultural landlords and the states were all crumbling. And that was because famine returned on a large scale. It was because of the Black Death, a great epidemiological disaster where a third to half of the population was wiped out. Now, that had that's a great example of how crises of a civilization are not absolute crises. So in medieval Europe, it wasn't that there were too many people. They could have transformed to a different more equal agricultural system and produced other crops besides rye and wheat and all the rest. Now, there are a lot of parallels without reducing it to the same situation, because clearly we're in a very different situation today. But I think we should be wary about overstating the resilience of capitalism. Why? Because all the parts of cheap nature that it has historically rested upon, cheap labor, energy, food, and raw materials, there are clear signs of wear on all of those processes, that they are all becoming more and more expensive. Even The Economist magazine comes out 2 weeks ago and says, oh, look, we have all these demographic changes in the world. It's the end of cheap labor. Of course, there's some overstatement to that. But there's a kernel of reality in there that's quite powerful, and I try to take this up in the book. So how does capitalism go about finding cheap natures? Well, we've seen a series of initiatives around that over the past 40 years. We can think of remote sensing and the ring of satellites around our planet. We can think of GIS and mapping various spaces of the world. We can think of new explorations for oil or for minerals, all of that. And none of that has succeeded in significantly reducing the price of extracting or producing those of the wealth of nature. That there is, in some sense, an impasse in the kinds of technologies that capitalism is able to produce today that is not promising to restore cheap nature. And so even if there is, say, a major industrial collapse of the world economy, which is possible. We've seen all the troubles in China. Brazil doesn't look like it's doing so great these days. All the big sources of instability in the world financial system are still there. Even if there is some major collapse of industrial production, it won't reset cheap nature. It won't magically bring back cheap oil or cheap coal or cheap minerals. And it won't magically reset cheap agriculture, because agricultural productivity is already faltering for reasons that have to do with climate change, but also the specific technical regimes of industrial agriculture. All right. So you have this question of, well, is it going to be collapse? Is it catastrophe? That is obviously the view of one part of the left today. And as you've pointed out with your colleague, Sasha, that there is a kind of theology of catastrophism that has tremendous appeal. And I think that we need to be very skeptical and very wary of that. One possibility is that we could see the intensification of the most militarized, most surveillance-oriented, most unequal tendencies of the past 30 years. We could see those amplified into a kind of politically driven, massively unequal world society in which markets were much more tightly controlled by the powerful for the benefits of the powerful. We see snippets of that. I think when the big banks can borrow money from the Fed, from the Federal Reserve at 0.25% and then loan that out at astronomically higher levels, including back to the federal government at 2.5% and higher, but for those of us paying credit card bills, of course, much higher, we see the demise of the most dynamic part of capitalism, that is the capacity to reinvest in the world, to raise labor productivity and to distribute the gains of that, however unequally, to distribute the gains of that. That story has come to an end. Capitalism is no longer the productive and efficient system that we still believe it is. And the record is right there in the labor productivity statistics for the past 40 years, in the agricultural productivity statistics. You can look at it. You don't have to be a radical to understand that capitalism is in a profound and powerful state of stagnation.
Well, of course, it's so easy to talk in the shorthand of capitalism as a sort of unified thing. And I know that's something that you are wary of. But when we talk about the crisis that the system may be facing, although you're emphasizing the importance of global historical processes, shouldn't we also be thinking about and remaining aware of the degree to which capitalism has always been a geographically uneven system?
That's right. And it's historically, it's been geographically uneven in many, many ways. But let me suggest that perhaps the most powerful way has been an unevenness between the commodity system or market society, in which most activities, including making your dinner and buying clothes, occur through the cash nexus, occur through the market. And on the other hand, vast oceans and land masses of uncapitalized life, of life that goes on maybe occasionally through cash transactions, but through where the reproduction of human and extra human life of forests and ecosystems and wetlands across the world, that reproduction occurs largely outside of the cash nexus. And there has been historically a profound unevenness between those two moments. You have what I've called oceans of commodification, or rather islands of commodification within oceans of cheap nature. And that asymmetry still exists, but in a much less robust way than ever before. And so there are many forms of unevenness, but I would just draw our attention to that the domain of the cash nexus of the market system is bigger than ever before, and the domain of life that is outside the cash nexus is smaller than ever before. And that's not something that capitalism can deal with, because it means that particular capitalists across the world, and large groups of them, have to start paying their own bills. They have to start paying the costs of reproducing forests or workers or others. And we can think of the slogan around immigration, that what would happen if all the immigrants stopped working for a day? Well, the whole system would fall apart. In fact, that's not just about immigration. That's a question of paying the costs of those services, whether they're labor or they're questions of ecosystem services, that to call for capitalism to pay its own way is to call for its abolition. Because capitalism is a system of cheap nature. Capitalism is a system of not paying its own bills. So what we're seeing is that as that asymmetry, that unevenness between the market and uncapitalized or uncommodified life, as that relationship changes in the present, capitalism is increasingly unable to find vast new opportunities for making significant profits. There's no more India to open up. There's no more North America to build railroads across. And in fact, all the places that are industrial and financial heartlands are becoming more and more expensive in capital's own terms.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, but I'm afraid we're completely out of time. Jason Moore, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha. It's been an honor, as always.
Jason Moore is an environmental historian and political economist. He teaches in the sociology department at Binghamton University. He is also the coordinator of the World Ecology Research Network and author of Capitalism in the Web of Life, Ecology and the Accumulation of Capital. That's published by Verso. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.